But and now, a father figure of space research, Professor Bernard Quatermass.
And cut to two.
Sir, after all the shocks and setbacks of your own career, what are your thoughts now?
I'm ashamed.
Well, I don't think you have any need.
To think that I might have contributed in any way to this disgusting charade.
Charade?
That's what I said.
Yes, Toby, it's well understandable, Toby. Note of
you
business,
asked for my thoughts, you're going to hear them.
Dr. Cap, I wonder if you'd like to
acknowledge... Right. Hand over to Cap.
Let him talk.
What we're looking at there is a wedding. A symbolic wedding between a corrupt democracy and a monstrous tyranny. Two superpowers full of diseases.
Professor Quatermass.
Political diseases, economic diseases, social diseases. And their infections are too strong for us, the small countries. When we catch them, we die. We're dying now. And they mock us with that thing? Well, their diseases are in that too. It can't live.
That is a most interesting contention. Unfortunately, we simply
It'll come to nothing.
Please.
Sooner than they think.
Let's leave it at that.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. World War III, week 27. Welcome to the Bristol Politics Show on the 4th of September 2026, streaming live from the Coombe Centre, close by Bristol City Centre. Don't believe a word we say, but we do try to share a few moments of clarity here from Bristol's Templar Port merchant venturer Duchy in the City of London's Empire of Lies, the mass media mind machine. Bristol's only national news show is coming to you live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, a djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com, that's 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Bristol Politics Show app, which is available free from GitHub and the Apple App Store at thisweek.org.uk. That's the way you find that, but it's not on the evil Google Play. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the Talk Radio stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday when he's operating, which he isn't this week, this month, we bring you the Richie Allen Show. So tonight, looking at Bristol's broken planning system, we keep hearing about this, particularly from Joe Banks, who's been writing about this for the last 3 or 4 years, and that tonight we'll be hearing about how there's planning permission being given for large buildings and building projects which are in floodplains, and also right next to rivers, which are then sinking into the river. So that's John Langley talking about that. We'll also be joined by Welsh Eco Village Network, as Linda Beamish, and Eco Village UK as well now, she is. Also a bit from Martin, keeps mentioning this Commodore from the Royal Navy, Steve Jeremy. So we'll be hearing a bit from him this week. He keeps popping up. He's very sceptical about whether there's any point in helping the Ukrainians, and he thinks they've lost the war. And also from this guy, Martyanov, who's a Russian commentator on the Ukraine war. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist zero-trust agenda, bending our minds with Orwellian BBC Verify, and boring us to tears with all those vacuous celebrities, puff pieces on the conspiracies, and hatchet jobs on the heroes. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and his vampire queen wage war on the British public, as well as Iran, China, Russia, the BRICS, and anyone who's not in their cult. Seems to me that they think that they can just spin themselves, spend a load of money on PR. We're not going to tell you how much, even though apparently we're public servants, you're not going to know. And hopefully everyone will think we're great. Well, of course, a lot of people do fall for it. Helping us to navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich in Bristol, Britain, and around the world, though, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, this week we've seen Andy Burnham do his first Prime Minister's questions. Can you just give us, you as a Labour Party member's point of view, what you make of Burnham and any differences, if there are any, between him and Starmer?
Well, he's obviously got better communication skills than Starmer. But obviously, in order to become Prime Minister, he's had to agree to various things you know, the permanent government, for example, you know, have basically said to him, you know, you've got to carry on the war with Ukraine. And he's enthusiastically joined. I mean, the first place he went when he went abroad was to Kiev. I mean, normally you might expect to go to America, but he went to Kiev. And also, of course, he's basically, he's trapped fundamentally, because the decision that we've got to increase spending on defence, he's kind of said, yes, we've got to do that, but that means we've got no money to do all the things we really want to do. And of course, the answer to all of this is a complete change of policy, but we're not going to see that from him in the short run. But of course, things may get very much out of control quite quickly, and then things will start happening.
So do you think that he's just looking for an opening to maybe to change policy, maybe to be a bit more pro-Palestinian or a bit more pro-Russia?
Well, they're obviously being a bit more pro-Palestinian from a very base.
Have they?
Yeah, but a little bit. Yeah, I mean, Miliband today is saying we're going to have sanctions on Israel if they can't, you know, because they're trying to annex the West Bank. But I think they'll be forced off the fence, because the Israelis are going to carry on being absolutely atrocious, and they're just not going to be able to defend the policy. And the Ukraine war, they've got more, you know, I'm afraid most people still buy into a load of rubbish about it, and the only way that's going to end is when the Russians decisively win, and then that'll be the end of it. So no matter what you think, it won't make any difference.
Okay, so, yes, but I'm just wondering if, you know, how honest and genuine you think this change is, if at all, because, you know, Britain is still involved in supplying weapons to this genocidal country called Israel.
That's true. But of course, what's going to happen now, there's going to be a by-election in Holborn and St Pancras, and it looks like Zach Polanski is going to be standing. And if the Israelis carry on doing their atrocious behaviour between now and when the election is held, then it's quite likely that Labour may lose that seat to the Greens. And that, of course, then puts Andy Burnham on notice. And of course, the war isn't going to end. It's going to escalate. And the war, escalating war, is going to lead to a massive oil price shock before Christmas, which will then quite possibly burst the AI bubble.
Well, we'll be coming to this later, where this again, the Americans ramping up the Iran war. Apparently, J.D. Vance refuses to call it a war. Apparently, it's not a war, according to him. I mean, it quite clearly and obviously is. Anyway, before we go and have a chat to John Langley, who's hanging on the line, I hope, listening. I hope you can hear us, John. Let's just dip into, because Starmer has resigned as an MP this week, rather like Farage did.
Yeah.
And the idea, of course, is that Polanski might, both Reform and the Greens are quite similar in that some of their senior figures aren't MPs.
Well, that's right, because there's a mismatch between the votes that people vote and the seats that people get in Parliament. And it's because the system doesn't work. I mean, obviously, in places like Ireland, the votes and the seats are pretty similar. In this country, the Labour Party's got a majority of hundreds, but in actual fact, they're supporting the country's like 1 in 5. But they've got a solid majority because the system basically is broke. And whoever wins, I mean, Reform are saying if they win, then in the first 100 days they're going to do all sorts of things, and they're going to sit. But of course, even if they win, they'll only win on 30% of the vote.
Well, they won't be able to do anything with the victory, really. I mean, it's interesting. It's a bit like the Makerfield.
Well, the thing is, the system is broke. It's just not fit for purpose. And we haven't had... Thatcher was in power for all the years she was in power. She never got 50% of the vote. Most people voted against what she wanted to do, but she had the power to force it through. And so we've got privatised utilities, deregulated financial markets, the creation of Al-Qaeda, her three great achievements.
Yeah. OK, so, well, let's have a listen now to Keir Starmer, who's resigned this week as an MP, and his blustering, well, he was telling us that he was never going to resign, or not going to resign, or whatever, just after the local elections back in May, June, July, August, September, 4 months ago, or 3 months ago, pretty much. No, it's more like 4 months ago. This is what Keir Starmer was saying.
Let me be clear, these are really tough results. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. And we have lost brilliant Labour representatives, people who put so much into their communities, so much into our party and our movement. And the voters have sent a message about the pace of change, how they want their lives improved. May was elected to meet those challenges, and I'm not going to walk away from those challenges and plunge the country into chaos. It was a 5-year term I was elected to do. I intend to see that through. I am feeling very much for the brilliant candidates, the brilliant councillors, the brilliant representatives that we have lost, because I know for them they have put so much into their communities, so much of their life into public service. And so I'm thinking about them and thinking about what we need to do to rebuild and to take our country forward.
So there he is. I intend to serve out my 5 years and I'm going to carry on. Only thing is, he's not.
Well, that's right. He's changed his mind.
Or someone had changed his... Do you think someone's had his arm up behind his back?
No, I think in actual fact he was only... He was very much a non-professional politician. He was the lawyer originally. And in actual fact, he found politics quite
uncongenial. A human rights lawyer who thought that it's okay to cut off people's water and starve them.
That's right. So, but the point is that he's... I mean, look at Jeremy Corbyn, for example. He's been a constituency MP in Islington for decades. And even when he was booted out of the Labour Party, he is not going to stand down. He will carry on doing what he's going to do. Because, he's a constituency MP par excellence. Whereas, of course, Starmer really is not a very, he's not that keen on politics. I mean, when he says he's going to go and do international affairs,
imagine... Blair. It's going to be another Blair.
Yeah, he's going to be Blair Mark II.
Oh,
yeah.
No, please. Blair was bad enough.
He may join Blair's little outfit, because there's plenty of money to be made there.
There is, isn't there? Oh, can you imagine that? People paying a fortune to see him speak. Actually, no, it won't be quite, it will be elites and think tanks and things like that, yeah. Which will be, wouldn't it be nice if when a politician is kicked out, they just go? I mean, actually, before the European Union, this was the norm. Once a politician was finished, that was it. They might go into work for a think tank, but you certainly wouldn't be, being put into positions of power like the European Commission or some, board of peace in the Middle East.
Well, I mean, most politicians, when they lose their seats, they go off to do other things. I mean, many Tory politicians are basically business people who just happen to do a bit of politics, so they just go back to doing what they've always done. I mean, Nigel Farage makes far more money from buying and selling commodities and various other things than he makes as an MP. He's made one...
Well, how come he hasn't got enough money to pay for his own security, then?
Well, you better ask him that, Tony.
Well, maybe he doesn't really want to donate to his own party, hey?
Well, I mean...
Maybe he could.
I think that, obviously the Reform are in the news because of their finances this week, but leaving aside the details of it, it's pretty obvious to anybody who's watching that Reform are massively funded by multi-billionaires from all over the place. They've got far more money than anybody else. The Labour Party traditionally was funded by the trade unions.
Have they got more money than the Tories, then?
Yes, they've got more money than everybody. I mean, everybody's jumping on the bandwagon and showering them
with
cash.
Will they be like Wilco? They'll just close and then they'll walk off with the cash.
Well, I mean, don't forget that the Reform UK is in fact a private company owned by
Nigel
Farage.
Maybe they will.
So they could do
that.
They'll
just say, well, actually, it looks like profit margins are coming down in the next few years. Why don't we just cash it all in and walk off with it?
It's quite possible that people are speculating that Farage makes it fed up of all the attention that he's getting, and that he may just decide to throw in the towel and, go back to making loads of money by hanging around in the city.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll be going back. We'll be going to have a listen to Burnham's first Prime Minister's questions after we've heard from John Langley. Now, I hope John is joining us on the line now.
Well, I hope so too.
Oh, hi, John. John Langley, you've written some a piece this week. Would you like to just remind me of the headline? I don't have it in front of me here.
Where Bristol City Council public money actually goes, I think, was the headline.
Right, and what about the shifting sands of building on floodplains?
I don't know about shifting sand, probably more like quicksand.
So could you just take us through these latest pieces that you've written? Because I think it's very important that we've got good local journalism. The problem it
well,
seems...
Well, I wouldn't call me a good local
well,
journalist.
Well, I think you are, actually.
That's why we're
hearing from you now. And if you look at the Bristol Post, I'm not saying they're not bad, but they don't do this sort of, I think, like probing analysis, the sort of thing that you do, and which is standing up to power. And you almost seem to take it as read that the people... are supposed to be running this city, we elect, are trying to pull the wool over our eyes.
Well, Shall I take you through the bullet points of my article?
Please do.
I think that would help. So, Gorham Homes, a council housing company with a net worth that's down from 820k in 2020 to over 4 million in 2024, which seems to be getting worse every year. 10 million plus owed to the council in land loaned notes, working capital finance climbing towards 5.9 million. In 2023, a council found zero completions despite years of upbeat reporting. And the chair, a gentleman by the name of Aman Dalby, OBE, who was formerly involved as a director in a Grenfell-linked body, currently chairs two other housing boards simultaneously. And there seems to be this sort of record of disasters.
Okay, well, let's just start with Gorham Homes, because this was set up, I think, was it by Mayor George Ferguson? The idea was, let's have an arm's length business, which is backed by the council and can take money from the council to build council houses, because they decided for whatever reason that the council couldn't do that anymore. Maybe that's for political reasons. But so this is a company which is wholly owned by the council, and of course we do know, don't we, a similar thing happened with Bristol Energy, where tens of millions of pounds went down the drain a few years ago.
Yeah, we can get to that as well.
Yeah, so anyway, sorry, Gorham Homes is a council run, council led but arm's length council house building company. Zero completions.
I know that, you know, there's a wonderful story behind this, because it was, Gorham was named after I've got to try and keep a straight face. It was named after a Bristol giant who overheated, got drunk, and fell asleep mid-race. And somebody is branding this kind of half a legend. So it's a disaster.
Who is Gorham? Who is Gorham? Just explain that.
Well, he's in Bristol folklore. And there were two. There was Gorham and... the name of the other guy escapes me, but the other guy was, legend says it, that he was the one who carved through the Avon Gorge. The river came from it, and Gorham was Redland. His point of inspiration was doing something which Redland, which never came about because of his drunken states and falling asleep and being a total disaster.
So, well, they sound to me like Celtic legends of some sort.
Well,
maybe
yes,
not so far back. I don't know.
No, I wouldn't say sort of Celtic legends, but certainly British. But it just seems bizarre that they would name this company after someone who, legend has it, was a complete disaster and not the successful one.
Yeah, okay. So what are they up to, Gorham?
Well, this is where it gets quite interesting, because they seem to sort of have a bit of a fetish, I would call it, for building on land that's likely to sink into the Avon, or certainly be flooded by the River Avon. And the two sites, there's one down past the harbour side, and there's one up by Temple Meads. It's just, I don't know, it's just bizarre what they're doing with it. Because in terms of, just trying to get my bearings, the one up by Temple Meads, or just past Temple Meads.
This is called the Boathouse.
That's the one, that's the Boathouse, yeah. Well, that seems to have started off as something like a good idea. The company that was actually building it went bust. It was then taken over by another company. And then that's the one which is allegedly slipping into the River Avon.
Well, it certainly does seem to be. I also would like to point out that this was one that the leader of the opposition at the time, Keir Starmer, actually came along to Bristol and did a whole photo shoot up there on the top with the Mayor Marvin Rees at the time, saying what a wonderful project this is. And then the company promptly went bust. And the reason it's gone bust, no one will actually disclose, but it's almost certainly because where it's built is right next to the River Avon. Now, yes. Before that, there was a petrol station on that site, which is not yes. too heavy. It's actually yeah. fairly, I mean, in terms of buildings, quite light, a petrol station. But they've built this multi-storey block of flats on top, which is extremely heavy, right next to the riverside. And I myself went and took some photos down there underneath. You can see over a period of weeks that certain parts of the bank are just slipping away underneath this housing development.
Yeah. And I'm going to go back to Bristol Energy again now, because this council isn't very good at setting things up, even at arm's length. They seem to fail. I mean, Bristol Energy being, you know, another tale in this sorry story, but the council should just leave things alone.
Well, what they did with Bristol Energy, let's just be clear here, is they said, people of Bristol, it was almost like a kind of oh yay proclamation. We suggest you get your energy from this Bristol Energy company because it will be very eco-friendly and it might even be a bit cheaper. A few people actually did, but it was a disaster. And I think it was something like £40-50 million was wasted, which they then had to write off.
You were absolutely right. There were losses of up to £43.8 million before being broken up and sold in 2020. It missed a genuine 2017 exit at £19.8 million, chose not to take it, and the final bill more than doubled. And even the council's own Grant Thornton report found the founding decision was never actually scrutinised. And I think in the end it was sold for a pound, wasn't it?
That's the auditors. So even the auditors are coming in and saying, look, you just haven't done this. You've done no due diligence. And of course, at the same time, people that don't pay their council tax towards this shower of very disorganised people pouring our money down the drain, they will get prosecuted and possibly even jailed for not paying these people who clearly aren't up to the job. But, I mean, I don't know if you had a look, but there was another similar development as to Gorham Homes, the housing over in Croydon.
Yes. I mean, if ever there was an example of how not to do something, Croydon is at the top of the league, isn't it? Because you've seen it, I've seen it, and I mean, I think Croydon are still actually trying to pay off the debts that they accumulated, which was absolute billions.
Well, this seems to be the thing nowadays, is that whatever it is that's running your life has got some massive debt hanging over it. And when you're paying for whether it's your council tax or your bus fares, actually what that money's going towards largely is just paying off a debt, John.
Exactly. And there are people in Bristol now, on this very day, still paying for Bristol's former disasters. And Bristol just doesn't seem to learn. It absolutely doesn't. It just goes from one disaster into another.
So what do you think's behind this? So surely we've got a new bunch of the Greens running the city now. They have looked at this. Have they dealt with it? Have they done anything?
Well, it's all about trying to make money, isn't it? You know, they're trying to balance the books.
Well, it seems to me to be about wasting money. Setting up something which costs a fortune,
yes.
which is not going to make any money at all.
Yeah, exactly. You've hit the nail on the head. But that's what they're trying to do, is they're trying to make money. And they're not a business. They're not a commercial enterprise. They're not in it for profit. And they should just be a council. And, of course, you know, you've got we haven't covered the other end of the river yet, up by the harbour side.
Yes, please do.
That's likely to be flooded. I mean, that's another abject failure. And as I said in my article, you know, what are people going to do? Are they going to give the residents free swimming lessons? Are they going to kick them out with scoop? They see that as an opportunity missed. If the basement of these buildings are going to be flooded, turn it into a real business opportunity. Now, if they'd have done it a few years ago and had like scuba diving lessons, they could have sent people down to look at Colston statue and made money out of it.
Okay. Yeah, so Just to tell you a little tale from about, maybe even 15 years ago, there was a, I always remember this tale. And over in Canesham, as people may remember, there was the chocolate factory. I think it was a big Cadbury's factory, am I right?
That's right.
Because there was plans released, and it was in the Bristol Post, or it was the Evening Post at the time, saying, we're going to build houses all around this chocolate factory. Well, the chocolate factory was on the River Avon, in just on sort of the Bath end in around Canesham. And that's just towards Bath from here, a bit further down the river. And the chocolate factory itself was up on a great big, well, it was on a mound, you know, on a hill. As Canesham itself is on a hill, not down by the river. But so they started, they set out all this marvellous housing development plan to build down there. And I remember there was a, we'd driven past, and I thought, I looked over and I thought, God, the whole of that area where they want to build the houses is flooded. Because there was a, I don't know, there had been a lot of rain, and because obviously it's in a floodplain. And so I didn't have a camera with me at the time, but I phoned up Bob Timoney, who was a cab driver, who was also a freelance photographer, and he grabbed the opportunity. He had a couple of hours later took a one of his rides over in that direction, but he stopped whilst he was taking the person by the side and took a whole bunch of photographs, and they were in the next day's paper, showing that they were about to build all these houses on an area which was flooded. So there just seems, it seems to me what's going on now is the planning system, John, is just broken. All of the checks and balances that the people we pay, the planning officers, etc., and I'm not blaming them, I just think that the system is set up to allow the developers to do anything they want, and the last person to get a look in is either the neighbours of a new development or the people who are going to be living there.
Yeah, and the reason is that councils cannot legally borrow to chase commercial profit or use profit as security. So therefore, they form these arm's length companies that aren't bound by that same trick of Croydon's brick by brick, for instance. And Bristol residents are kind of called shareholders, but you can't sell, you can't exit, you can't discipline the board the way real shareholders can. And so it's a bit of a con, really, although having said that, it is a legal one. But, you know, there are so many loopholes to get round various things that Bristolians don't really get a chance to look in at all and have their say. And when they do go to the council, they're usually fobbed off with some excuse.
Yes, I think that's the normal. That's the normal thing we get from the council nowadays, is some sort of standard reply. They're not really interested in engaging with. In fact, I mean, my own take on this is, it does seem as if our local authorities are becoming a bit like multinational businesses. So they're bringing people in from big business whose approach is, well, who are these people who are asking us questions? We'll only deal with people who ask us the right questions. I mean, we've got this bizarre situation, John, you probably know about, where the council leader, the green guy, Tony Dyer, doesn't really do press interviews. He's done one or two, but he doesn't. He won't come up if say there's a controversial article like yours comes out about why are the council building in floodplains and sinking mud and sand or whatever. He should really be, you know, that he'll get a call, his office would get a call from local ITV or BBC saying, could you just answer some of these questions? He always says no. And so instead, rather than not appearing at all, what he's done is he comes up occasionally with a woman called Heather Mack, who is his deputy leader, and she asks him some questions on YouTube, and that's considered to be his public press profile. It's not really what I would say is people who are being held to account properly in the public sector, is it?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, that's very much in-house PR, isn't it? That's what it is, basically. It's one backing the other up all the way, doesn't really give the answers to the questions that really matter to people.
Well, she doesn't ask them. No, she asks those little softball questions. And it is, I mean, watching it is actually quite painful. It's just like, it's embarrassing. Anyway, I mean, our politicians are just not doing the job. So look, I mean, I think just, it'd be nice to widen the discussion out and bring Martin in. But before we do that, just is about housing generally, because obviously the houses need to go somewhere. somewhere. What's happening here is the developers are choosing cheap bits of land to build the houses on for purposes of profit. Obviously the more appropriate places, the brownfield sites, etc., to be repurposed for house building, they're much more expensive than floodplains. That's why we're seeing this ridiculous thing, like the old petrol station being turned into a block of flats. Still nobody's been in there. That's about 6-7 years they've been building that place, the boathouse. Yeah. Can you just tell us a bit more about the other site into the harbour?
Well, that one, as I say, is, it's the same council, different name, same shape, because it was a caravan site, to my best recollection, owned by the Caravan Club, and then there was some controversy over felling trees there. And then slowly it's sort of developing into a floodplain site where they're going to build houses, that will probably, you know, by all accounts have moorings attached to them because that's the only thing that they'll be fit for. And I just don't get it. I really just don't get it, Tony. I rack my brain and all I end up with, and you'll be aware of this as much as me, that instead of painting murals round by where the fountains were, they should have a mulberry bush that we can all keep going round and round.
Well, that particular site was a lovely caravan site. It was absolutely unique in the city where people could come from all over the country and stay here in Bristol in the city centre for a reasonable amount of money. Also, of course, they've been felling trees. You know what? I think next week we're going to have Bristol Tree Forum on here to talk about that, because it's a particularly nasty thing for the so-called Green Council to do, to find the only bit of green space around the harbour there and just chop all the trees down. I mean, this is not green at all. Anyway, it'd be interesting to see what Vasily has to say about that. Look, so before we try and talk about some of the solutions, right,
to
this.
Solutions?
Well, I mean, this is to the housing crisis, right? Let's have a listen, because ITV did an excellent report this week. By the way, ITV are being bought by Comcast right now, which is a big American corporation. And I would suggest what we're seeing now is really the last of ITV local news. What we'll be getting soon is a sort of mush version, a rubbishy version. At the moment, it's still just about, and I'm hoping, I mean, it's very much like when HTV was slowly closed down. They used to do documentaries and they stopped them doing that. Just because there was no need to do it. They had a whole documentary strand called West Eye View, in fact, half-hour documentaries every week. That disappeared. And I think what's happening now right across the country with this Comcast sale is ITV local news will be disappearing. So this is one of the last things we've seen from them. Let's have a listen now to ITV's report on housing in Bristol, because it is one of the most expensive places to live outside London. We have a serious housing crisis in the city.
Cost of renting in Bristol has gone through the roof. In fact, official figures reveal it is now the most expensive place in the country in which to rent, with tenants spending an average of 45% of their salaries every month on rent alone. That's nearly 10% more than the national average, 3% more even than London. The average cost of a property in Bristol now is £1,885 a month. In the last decades, rents here have increased 67%. And one renter who's a key worker has told us she's having to make significant life choices just to be able to afford to live here.
I always thought I wanted kids, but if I can't have a financially stable life, then I won't have children. And I know I'm not the only woman who feels that way.
The Renters' Rights Act came into force in May with the idea of protecting tenants by banning no-fault evictions and limiting rent increases. But landlords are telling us they now have extra costs and their profit margins are significantly down, forcing many of them to leave the industry.
I think more and more will leave now, with new landlords' ombudsmans coming in and registration, because it's all going to come at cost to the landlord. Nothing's going to be for free. And it's just going to, you know, some of that cost will be passed on to tenants, and it's just going to make the problem even worse for them.
And letting agents are telling us the rental market is dwindling, with too many tenants chasing too few properties.
That stock level is probably the biggest issue. So when you've got the amount of people that are looking, it said if I had 101 beds to rent out, they would all be rented within a two-week period.
So what are the solutions? Well, more social housing is being built in the city. The city council also advocate rent caps, but that needs central government support. It seems there is no end in sight to the sky-high prices tenants in Bristol are having to pay.
So make the best use of watching ITV local news while you can. It's about the only decent news service in this country at the moment. The BBC are very it's a bit too establishment. But anyway, they're making some important points there, Martin. I mean, I didn't realise that actually Bristol is now more expensive to rent in London. Rents here have gone up 2/3 in the last decade.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a private renter.
So what's going on here? And are there ways of fixing it? Because there's clearly a massive demand and not enough supply.
Well, I mean, what we should not have done is sell off council housing in the 1980s. It was stupidity. And of course, if you do that,
but you would still have the demand, wouldn't you?
You would.
But much of that demand is driven by migration and people having kids.
No, it's also driven by Bristol is a relatively successful city, so people come here to work. But as George Ferguson, who used to be the mayor, points out, that in actual fact, if you're poor in an expensive city, you actually have a very low standard of living. So we've still got some of the most deprived communities in the
country.
So
we're driving the poor out. Although actually, some people who don't have a lot of money have just decided, well, I'm going to live in a van.
Well, that's right. So everybody's, you know, trying to find solutions for themselves. But underlying all of this is the destruction. I mean, we should not have sold off the council housing stock.
Okay,
it was a very successful policy.
I know
it's very easy
to go back 40 years and say we shouldn't have done something. But what can we do now?
Well, what we could be doing is taking over existing empty properties and turning them into council housing. You don't have to build any new houses.
What about what John has been talking about, this organisation Gorham Homes? The council has set this up to build. They haven't built anything yet.
Yeah, well, one of the problems with that, as George Ferguson pointed out, is because you've still got the possibility of right to buy. So if the council builds council houses, after a while, the people in the council houses will have the right to buy, which means that the council will definitely lose money on it. Now, that has to be changed at national level. You need national policies to deal with all of this. Everybody knows
I don't know that the right to buy is really a thing anymore, certainly within our housing association. And one of my neighbours, she wanted to buy her flat, she couldn't.
Yes, that's because basically the people who managed to buy their houses back in that era were given lots of free money by the government.
What I'm saying is it's not happening now so much. So anyway, it'd be nice to get you to actually answer the point, which is, why is it? So why is the... rents so high, how has this happened? I know, but for example, under the Conservatives, landlords, the tax changes were made, so it was actually more difficult for landlords to actually make money. Some of them have either put the rents up, or they're selling properties to financial institutions.
Well, I used to live on one side of Stapleton Road 11 years ago. I'd been living in that flat for 10 years before that. And, of course, what happened in the 2008 crash is that all the buy-to-let landlords went bust, including mine, and everybody got booted out. And that's what will happen now. My landlord eventually will go bust, or he will want to sell it, and then I'll be out on the street, and I won't be able to get anywhere else because there isn't anywhere else. And that's the reality. When this crash hits in, and it may well come in before Christmas, that is what's going to happen. The buy-to-let landlords will flee the market, and everybody will be booted out.
Well, it seems to me this Gorham Homes organisation could be a great answer, but it's almost as if they are trying to operate for profit, and therefore they're building on all the wrong places. And by the way, they haven't actually built anything.
Well, and the answer to that, obviously, is for councils to have the authority to do what they used to do. The council houses in Bristol were built by the Bristol City Council in the 50s and 60s, and they just got on with it and did it. Boring, I know, but that's really the answer. It always was the answer.
Okay, John, back to you. Do you see any solutions, and what's your diagnosis as the doctor on this one of the problem?
I mean, where do we begin? I understand the point about people coming here for work. But why Bristol? I just don't understand it. Okay, I think this is still the second most expensive city in the country?
No, it's the most expensive. Most expensive.
It is the most expensive.
3% more than London average, apparently, now.
So why are people still coming here?
Because they like it here.
Well, the marketing must be extraordinary in the first place.
Well, I don't know if we're marketing ourselves.
I accept people like it here. But it's becoming too much. As far as I recall, I think there are 16,000 on Bristol's housing waiting list already. And I know in terms of the Western Harbour Cumberland Basin, originally the 2022 vision promised 50% affordable housing. But what is affordable housing? Because the developers want to make their money back, and they're reducing the amount of property available for council. It's just, as I said, here we go around the mulberry bush again. And I wish I was a genius. I wish I knew what the answer was. But every time I look at the council, the way it operates, I just go back to scratching my head. And the point is that I'm actually almost bored now completely because I've done it so often.
Well, how about buying a vehicle, living in a vehicle? Because that's what hundreds of people have done. We've got around about 800 people now in Bristol, and the council seems to be doing their best to drive them out.
They are, because I think that there's some now in Brislington. They're all outside of the city centre, and that doesn't work either, you know. And as I keep saying to you, Tony, I don't know what the solution is. As I said, we've got roughly 16,000 on the housing list already. Where are they going to put people?
Well, I mean, if there are plenty of derelict and empty sites, by the way, right close to the city centre. There's an enormous site which has been empty, was demolished. Demolition was about 15 years ago in St Paul's, actually right by the M32 motorway. A great big section of land there. It's used for a few weeks in the summer by a circus, which is friendly with the city council, and they let them come in there. And so the most of the year it's completely empty. There's no reason why people in vans with a few portaloos, some standpipes, can't move in there, is there?
It costs money, doesn't it? The council doesn't want to spend the money. I think it would, in one sense, it wants to bring people in who are earning good money, shall we say, looking at the proposed, well, what's going to be the development around the city centre, and it doesn't want to know the people who don't have the money. That's what it seems like to me.
Yeah, I mean, this is a sort of form of Martin. It's just social cleansing, isn't it, really?
Yes, I mean,
gerrymandering.
If you think back to after the war, in London and in Bristol and other big cities, planning was much stronger than it is now. So you would put a sort of middle-class housing estate where people were buying their houses with mortgages right next to a council estate where people were renting from the council. And they deliberately created mixed communities. You know, if you walk around the East End of London, you'll see what it was like. Because they didn't, it wasn't market-driven. The idea is we've got to put everybody in housing. And, of course, if you've actually got a solid council house sector, that actually reduces the cost of people trying to buy houses.
I mean,
houses.
If you think about Notting Hill, Ladbroke Grove area, actually that was deliberately done like that after the Second World War.
That's
where
right.
There were bomb sites. They decided, right, we've got a whole road of mansions here. Well, let's just build a whole block of council housing.
That's right. That's right. And, of course, at the same time, you build local schools where you hope all the children will go. It's social planning. But, of course, we've given up on all of that. That was what the Thatcher Revolution was all about. Let's just let the market rip and see what happens. Well, what happens is what's happened, which is loads of people don't get anywhere to live.
Oh, the market. The market always seems to be making a mess of things. Anyway, John, just wonder if you can wrap up by telling us whatever it is you want to say finally, and also whereabouts people can find your work.
Thank you. Well, I was just about to add to that, really, by saying the average price of a property in Bristol now is somewhere between 357,000 to 406, and going up, depending on whether, you know, it's detached or semi-detached or happens to be in one of the nicer areas. And I honestly believe that the people in the outlying areas of Bristol are being well, I wouldn't say pushed out, but they're at the raw end of the deal because the city wants to make money. I don't think it has a great deal of interest in the people who live in areas such as Withywood, perhaps. It's interested in the money people coming into the city, buying up the expensive properties, buying up the apartments. And that's what the council is interested in because they can extract the most amount of council tax from those people. And that's my summary. That's my very honest opinion.
Yeah, it sounds to me like they're operating just like a profit-making business, actually.
Yeah, they are. And having said that, look at the results of trying to operate profit-making businesses so far.
Which are?
That's it. Anyway, if anybody wants to catch up with me, I am the almighty gob, that's G-O-B, not the...
not gob.
The higher, not, no, not the higher version. I'm the low end of the market. But yes, I can be found on thealmightygob.com. And thank you very much for having me on your programme again.
Before you go, John, I'd just like to ask you one thing. Do you have sympathy with people like the van dwellers who just decided to throw in the towel, say, look, we're going to live in the city, but we're not going to buy into this broken racket?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, if I wasn't so, unwell, should we say, disabled, then I would be doing it myself in going back to the old days when I was actually living outdoors. And I do feel sympathy. And I think what it's going to do, it's going to build like a subculture, a sub-community of people who just choose to say, stop the system, I'm going to live in a van, and that's going to be my life.
Disconnect from Babylon.
Yes, absolutely.
So anyway, John Langley, thanks ever so much for joining
us.
And we're joined in the studio also here today by Linda Beamish. Linda, you're involved in this Welsh Eco-Village Network. I've known you for quite a while. You've got an interest in this idea of building eco-villages, and you've turned up to Bristol today in your van. So can you just give us an idea of what it is? I mean, because we've got quite a few people out there, you and I both, in a similar point of view here, that see this as a broken system, and they're really no point in trying to buy into it anymore.
I just think, well, it really is broken. The Monopoly board game has been won and nobody's admitting it. So why, I mean, our lecturer said, everybody just accepts the fact that values and prices are going to go up and up and up and continue to go up. And every bailout of the bankers is sort of acro-propped at that level. It sort of stabilises out. It might dip just a tid, and then it comes back up again. But in the end, you've only got that many people with the amount of money needed to be able to live in any of these new properties anyway.
So now you've got a background yourself in actually being involved in the building industry, if you want to call it that. Well, it is an industry. It's actually a real industry rather than AI or something.
Yeah, exactly.
So can you just tell us a bit about that, how you got interested in building, retrofitting buildings, that sort of thing?
Well, from childhood, I wanted to be either an architectural designer or get involved in environmental side of things. And I wasn't allowed to because girls have families, not careers, said my stepfather. So I put myself through and started working for architects locally, working in the understair cupboard at home, doing it, getting it wrong, taking it in, coming back, doing it again and again. And eventually I put myself through college, working self-employed, paying my way. And going back to the building to be built in an area where you're in flood risk and it's going to be undermined, we were taught in building law that the architect is held accountable. So they must make sure that where they are putting the proposals is in accordance with the land, whether it's going to be dehydrated, cracking, subsiding, flood risk or whatever, and that falls onto the architect, the design team.
And so what the developers are doing is they're just taking architects' designs and sticking them in inappropriate places. They're cutting this link between the architect and the land.
So who's held responsible in that case? Because, I mean, that's actually passes down to your children. If you get it wrong, it doesn't die with you. You're held accountable forever.
Well, I don't know, but I look at some of these new estates that have been built in the last 5 years or so, and I wonder if an architect has even been involved. Looks to me as if it's all been some sort of computer-aided design AI that tries to squeeze as many of these little rabbit hutches or Lego buildings into an acre as possible.
Brownfield sites, premium. You don't have any planning concerns when it's a brownfield site. And they're doing it in the greenfield sites just the same, but they shouldn't be.
So do you know of any good examples of where places are being built that were, you know, they're actually good places to live and reasonably affordable?
Eco-villages, there you go. In a word, in a nutshell, but you need to have intentional communities to do that, and I think we're being forged into that now, aren't
we? So what is an intentional community?
So it's best formed of family and friends who share similar concerns and visions. You know, where we get to live nowadays, we're thrown all together with people who've never met before, and you get on, but, you know, realistically, when you form an intentional community with your friends and your families, you're usually in the same boat.
Yeah. Right. Well, hang on, because an intentional community. So that's the idea. Is it sounds a bit sort of hippie-ish, really? You know, like,
well, yeah, that's what,
is it like a commune?
Yeah.
A commune?
No,
so you buy a big building, invite all your friends, and
well, yeah, but then if the person that buys that building has the money, then they have the ability potentially to be in control of it and decide when to sell it. So that doesn't quite work, does it? We found that didn't work before.
And what about actually managing a building or land or a community? Because this is a big part of it all. How do you actually make sure that the decisions are good decisions that are being made and include everybody in those decisions?
Sociocracy.
What?
Sociocracy. Sociocracy. So all of the eco-villages more or less fall under the guise of sociocratic circles.
What does it mean? What does that mean?
No head. So we've got this system at the moment where everything is top-down, which causes a big problem, because even if those people care, do they actually bother to ask the people that their decisions actually affect?
Well, we were just talking about this in relation to the city council.
Exactly.
Doing what they want, really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And who's above them and stopping it? More of the same. Top down. It should be bottoms up, really, shouldn't it?
Bottoms up. Yes, well, I see what you mean. But, I mean, that thing is that you can lose direction, can't you, if you've got that sort of thing. So everybody is... What often happens is everybody gets a veto. So these sorts of things, especially when there's personalities come into it, can stagnate.
Well, it can. But, I mean, the system as it is currently does not work. And we knew that a recession was imminent from 2002. If we knew, then every taxpayer in the world has been failed by their successive governments.
Now, I know you're linked up with these Welsh people. What do you make of them, the Welsh Eco-Village Network?
Well, you promoted me to Group Monterey Eco-Village Network UK even before that in 2011. Pentrefika Gymru, so I'm admin there, Catherine. So, yeah, I will be travelling off to Wales next and seeing what I can see. Catching up with Catherine so we can start to put some things together. There's a lot of people who want to live differently. The stress is so immense. Living in housing you can't afford.
Yeah.
You've got no choice at the moment. And those in vans, they have no choice. There's no options left. And the boaters, I mean, that's great. You can move on the river. But I know Bristol Council are against the boaters.
Well, they've been putting up the mooring fees, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they had this famously, 2022, I think it was, they had a vote at the council where they said, we want fair rents and we don't want any large increases in rent. And then literally the next week, some of the mooring fees, they doubled. So this is the council hypocrisy. So yeah, but you also, I know you, I've also had a bit to do with these people up at Brancaster and the oh God, what are they called?
Common Rights Holders.
Yeah.
Galton District Common Rights Holders Association, Chakra.
Chakra, that's right. Yeah. Now, this is something almost kind of ancient. It's sort of like a relic from the past. So you've got massive commons up in North Norfolk, all the way along the coast there, and these people are supposed to manage those and own them, but I'm not sure how much they own them and manage them. This is a very old system of managing and owning land, and they have had trouble with a lot of private companies, individuals' estates. For example, there's a golf course up there. There's also a local lord of the manor that keeps encroaching on their bits and pieces of land. So can you give us a bit of an update of what's been happening? And what is a common right holders association?
Well... It's formed to represent the common rights holders.
How many of them are there?
Oh, gosh. What, on the committee or the common rights holders? About 350 to 400, somewhere in the middle.
So this is a right that you get, which is part of the deeds of your house. So you've got rights?
Those are some. So Barrow Hill Common, Barrow Common, those are with half rights. But the rest are inherited, or you can buy or lease, dependent. I lease one.
Right. So the idea is that you are a commoner?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah. And you have got rights. What sort of rights?
On mine, I can collect samphire and herbage and just basics. I haven't got too much on mine. But
so there's lots of reeds there, which can be quite useful for thatching and sort of thing.
That's right. And actually, there has been progress in on that now, because it's also about biodiversity. So when the reeds aren't cut, you've minimised the amount of species that it can actually support, whereas when you thin them out, you can encourage more in.
Right, so there's also livestock.
There is. Well, this is where it starts to fall over, isn't it? So you can't actually put a fence up to keep your livestock in. You have to be fenced against.
Right.
So that means that those who own the buildings and the land adjacent to the common land have the responsibility to fence against, and of course they don't want to.
Why not?
Because they don't want a load of commoners in the end of their garden, I suppose, or their cattle or whatever.
Well, if they don't put a fence up, the cattle are going to wander into their garden.
Well, they would, but it's when they go onto the road, Tony.
Right.
So when a horse did get out and get onto the road and had an accident with a vehicle, shall we say...
Well, that's the vehicle's fault, isn't it?
If there's a horse on the road. Yeah, it is, but actually, no, it's going back to the person who owns the horse now.
Really?
So after that, the rules have been changed, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
This is annoying, because actually, back in the day, you know, these commons, okay, you'd have a cattle grid around the edges of them, and, you know, there's a big sign saying, watch out, there might be animals on the road, and then if you crash into a horse and kill it, then apparently it's the horse owner's fault. That sounds a little bit... A little bit unfair. Anyway, these things, there is this, I don't know if you know about it, but there's this book called The Tragedy of the Commons, which is all about how, by their very nature, commons are impossible to manage, and therefore that land should be enclosed, should be privatised, and the idea of having lots of people with common rights on land should be thrown out.
Well, that's all right until you get to war, isn't it? You know, when you've really got poverty, and the reason why you had the common land in the first place was because people had been fenced out of the land that they were living upon and foraging or whatever. So that was all taken away, and the sheep took precedent, and people ended up being given the common land. Well, people still have the rights to that, and if you have got war and there's nothing on the shelves, you're going to want to exercise your rights even more. You'll need to.
Yeah.
For your family's sake, really.
This is historic, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of commons, this is the pre-Reformation, pretty much, or actually, no, pre-English Civil War, way of managing land, that you had a whole bunch of people that lived in a village. Let's just forget the cities for a minute, but in the countryside. And back in those days, the land was really considered to be everybody's. Although it was actually officially owned by the lord of the manor, everybody that had rights to live in that village had rights on the land too.
Mm. Well, yeah, and where you've got the creeks, you know, people boat and shellfish and, you
Gosh,
know.
That's true, because this common is on the coast, there's all sorts of other rights
Absolutely.
That come with it.
Absolutely, and there's spring water as well.
You talked about samphire.
Samphire.
Samphire. What is that?
They call it an oceanic form of asparagus, but it isn't really. But it's quite nice and very good for you.
It's quite tasty.
It is tasty.
Really, I had some. I'm not so sure. it's not too bad. Anyway, look, it's lovely to chit-chat with you, but what do you think are the chances of actually having some of these I mean, there is this place, Findhorn, up in Scotland, which was set up, I think, I don't know if it was by the CIA or somebody, but it was, I mean, it's supposed to be a lovely eco-village, but it's a kind of bit of a weird place. It was built on the corner of a NATO air base, so you can be sitting with sort of in a circle, with your legs crossed, singing with the hippies up at Findhorn, and suddenly you get a wash from a whole load of jet exhaust washing across you. You know, it absolutely stinks, kerosene. But I mean, they are supposedly trying to make this a thing in the UK. Do you think there's any chance of it?
Well, there were others, weren't there? And still are. So it's not just Findhorn, there's Hockerton Housing Project. These are all quite expensive to start on that level. The CAT, which was used in the lecture room and as an exemplar of what we needed to aim to achieve by way of designs, that target. Lammas Eco Village, which has led to the One Planet Development OPD, and Tinker's Bubble, which is now approved as well. So you've got different levels. I mean, we were looking at the sort of things that Lammas were doing, because that actually helped originally the farmer who owned that land as well. And there's an awful lot of farmers who are suffering because the government seems to only go down the big route, and it's corporate and it's commercial. And it's about making these little digits on a screen tail longer.
Well, this is the trouble, isn't it? If you get a load of people living in an eco-village on a piece of land,
that's right,
they're not spending any money.
No,
because
they're
getting all their food from the land, mm-hmm. They're spending their time there, and so this is very bad for economic growth.
But the other way around, Tony, is when you've got all these councils that are in debt, you can actually be saving them an awful lot of money. If we are allowed to exercise our community right to build and our community right to build, if only the councils would accept the fact that they've got a responsibility to us, which all these councils haven't admitted or accepted.
Well, I mean, we're talking here a lot about the countryside, but mm-hmm. actually in the cities there are housing co-ops too, aren't there?
Yeah, and there's co-housing. I mean, in Stroud, we went there when we went to, Stroud Communiversity 2019, which was organised by architect Max Comfort and his team. So we went on to site visits up there, and then there was a microbrewery and, something mill as well, which I can't...
Ruskin Mill,
that's
right,
the one.
Okay, because this stuff does happen.
That was really interesting.
It doesn't, I think, get anywhere near as much publicity as it should do, because really, in a way, these people, whether it's in the city with co-housing and housing co-ops, or the countryside with these eco-village projects, they're not really being held out to people as an alternative.
Yeah.
And in fact, even here in Bristol, with hundreds of van dwellers, they're finding it difficult to find space to live.
Yeah, and yet they were. I mean, for example, North Norfolk District Council held an annual Green Build exhibition, which started off at Binham Memorial Hall, which was quite small scale. Kate Edwards' Cobb Building was there, and they had all sorts of very practical, inexpensive solutions. And then it grew and grew and grew and ended up at Felbrigg as an annual event, where it was far more upscaled, big and expensive. And as we know, we've got all these solar farms everywhere and wind farms, and they're not really that sustainable because you've got to run back and forth and maintain everything, which isn't really solving much.
Well, the thing is that the countryside has changed so much. Even in my lifetime, there was a... I'm trying to think of the name of the guy. Robin Page? I think he was a guy... He was a writer... And after the Second World War, he wrote a book called The Death of the English Village, I think. And Robin charted this whole... I mean, he was talking about, say, for example, even in the time of the Second World War, there was massive changes in the countryside as tractors suddenly appeared. And all the men were told, no, you're going to have to go fight in the infantry division against Hitler, right? And the thing is that after the war, a lot of those people didn't come back to the countryside, or they came back to the countryside to find their jobs had been taken by tractors. And so slowly but surely since then, particularly around London but elsewhere too, the countryside has become a place where the rich retire, and people from, you know, wealthy people from London will go and buy a place and move. And if you go into many of these villages now, maybe there's a pub left if you're lucky, but they're kind of dead almost. So the countryside's changed so much.
Well, and you've got all the second homeowners. I mean, it's dire, and you've got people who don't understand the land living there, telling those that do how to do it because they've got the money.
But it's a bit, yeah. So, do you see any? Have you been to and seen any examples where people have done this successfully? Then,
in what way?
Well, just bought a bit of land, bought a house, and actually set up a kind of, with enough people to make it a viable place to live.
Monkton Wild Court, you mean?
Well, right? That's another one. Yeah, that's one. That was a school, I think, which was taken over.
It was. Or it was gifted, was it not? It was gifted to the community. Originally, that was working beautifully, as you know as well. Until those trustees moved
in. Oh, yes. Oh, God. It was sabotage, basically.
Completely.
There's a bunch of people turned up.
I mean, how much would that have been worth on the property market?
Well,
I think
it's kind of gone back to normal now, but various people, Simon Fairley and Jill, were ejected
completely
from there, who were running a thing called the Land Magazine from there.
Yeah.
So it's now been brought back into their... Well, it's become a bit anodyne again. But anyway, there's some of these places. There's always politics in these communities. Have you got any hints or ideas about how to keep the politics out of running a place like that? Is it impossible or not?
I think one has to be careful when you're looking at what you might be able to do to the politicians. But basically, the politicians sold, as far as I can see, everybody to the banks when they bailed them out in 2008 without any caveats, because historically you can see repeat. If you're going to give money away and it's the taxpayers' funds you're giving, should you not be protecting the taxpayers and controlling that oversale of debt? I mean, the Economist's global debt clock, I think they turned off in the end, but I mean, we were up to about 70 trillion combined governmental US dollars, I think it was, in debt.
Well, maybe there'll be a fiscal event, as they call it, the last few weeks. Faisal Islam, by the way, it's interesting, he was talking about this for the first time. He's starting to say, well, actually, maybe it will crash. But we know that this is not real money.
No, it's not.
Is not real money. The real wealth comes from land.
Yeah, totally. And you can't live without the land, ultimately.
But if they take it off you and then you become landless, then they've got you.
Yeah.
You have to go back to them.
And they're criminalising homelessness and poverty, basically.
All right. Well, just to wind up, what about the whole sort of climate issue? Because there's lots of talk about climate change, changing the way we use land. What do you make of this? There's a new way of doing things coming along, which is getting rid of coal, getting rid of oil, using windmills, all this sort of thing, solar power. What's your take on the whole climate thing?
Well, I think they're deriving it because if you can steer the market, you can invest where you want to. So you know you've got controls over that. So it's a very one-sided thing to look at one problem, i.e. carbon dioxide, when there's methane, which is at least 21 to 22 times worse than CO2. So and actually we could all have free fuel free heating and be running our own vehicles using methane. And once you've got the methane running through the engine, you've created an electrical current, then you can put that into a hydrogen cell and run on hydrogen. So your waste products are oxygen, O plus O2 plus O3 plus H2O water. Hey presto.
Wow, you sound like an organic chemist. Anyway, I thought we'd just finish with a listen, because there's just been this thing going around village halls all around the UK called the People's Emergency Briefing. And they don't allow it to go onto YouTube. It's not being put onto YouTube.
Really?
But people in village halls have been watching it. It's organised by Chris Packham and other people.
Yeah.
But I noticed this week that there is actually a critique of it has been put up there by a chap called Paul Burgess, who I think has done quite a good job. So he's saying there's some good things about this, but there are various things which are alarmist. And he does go quite deeply into this whole business you were talking about just how bad is CO2 and is it being exaggerated. So let's have a listen to Paul Burgess now, as just an extract from his talk, and I'll put a full version of this up on our show page tonight at thisweek.org.uk.
Mankind has added CO2 to the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution. Fact. I would argue that most of the additional CO2 is due to mankind. Fact. Well, hold on here, you agree, don't you, then? Well, yeah, I agree with that. CO2 is a warming gas. It warms the atmosphere. Fact. Hold on. So, where are you, Paul? Well, I'm actually the realist. I'm actually the scientific side. You see, CO2 has less and less effect as you add it. So, I've done a paper going way back which explains the medieval warm period, the Roman warm period, all using the ocean cycle method. So, what's the difference between me and the alarmist on CO2? It's so simple. We both agree that if you double CO2, you'll get about 1 degree centigrade warming. So we can expect, overall, the effect of CO2. Now, there's other factors can come in and cool it, but that will warm the temperature of the Earth by about 1 degree centigrade. That'll take about 175, 180 years for that to happen at the current rate of CO2 increase. Well, both sides agree on that. The other difference is the other side say, oh, no, the warming that's caused by that adds more water vapor, which adds more warming, which adds more warming, which adds... It's called positive feedback. That's the only difference between the two sides. That is really the only difference. So my work can be shown here. This is the temperature, first of all, according to the satellites since 1982 when they started reading, right up to 2025. Now, this is my work using the oceanic index work I do, explaining those temperatures for that period. Dead on. Right? And this is now the CO2 contribution. Now, I mean, that period, the CO2 contribution was about 25%. In this early period here, it was the CO2 would have actually warmed the Earth more than was allowed to, because the oceans were in cool phases and they sucked out the heat. And the period we're in now, as you can see on the other end of the scale, the actual temperatures are higher than what be caused by the CO2. So that's the period we're in now that they're trying to use for alarmism. And by the way, this, of course, explains the hiatus in the temperatures up to 2010. My work explains the hot 1930s, the cooling after 40s to the 70s, causing the Ice Age warming scare, all that. And it goes back historically and explains everything. So that's where I am. So, but I base everything I do on evidence and science, and observation is the king. So, I ask you, a part of that is in the paper, but I obviously do big subjects on that, big videos. And I'm actually making a big documentary about that now. So you're welcome to question me anytime. You're welcome to question in the comments below, but stick to evidence. Question the evidence. That's what I'm about. And I just can't believe that these people are doing this. You know what? I think Chris Packham is sincere. I think all these people are sincere. But the effect of what they're doing, trying to scare people, is deplorable.
Well, there's another take on it. And it's a pity that they don't put that up on the internet, because I think what would happen is lots of people like that was... Oh, gosh, what's his name? Paul Burgess, he would be on there saying, hang on a minute, this is wrong and that is wrong, and everyone would be able to look at that and scrutinise it. And so maybe that's why they haven't put it up on the internet. The idea was just to show it around the country in village halls, town halls, church halls, that sort of thing, but in a very managed environment. And he explains that at the beginning of that video. So what did you make of that?
Well, yeah, but with CO2, all you need to do is plant trees. Can you imagine if every wall in Bristol was covered in biotexture living wall material, so we had greenery everywhere? Or if you walk down a pavement with chamomile, am I going back to hippie roots, possibly? My lecturer used to say something about my muesli sandals, but I don't know. But I think that people have had enough. And whilst it may be slowly filtering into village halls, a lot of people in the villages are already quite aware, is how I feel. And I've got to say, when you're talking about breaking free from things, there's also Albion. You know, a lot of people have formed Albion as a republic of Albion, following the guidelines of Kevin Annett, who's doing similar overseas in the, you know, Canada, I think.
Okay, so what's that about?
And that is about, well, over there, tribes are managing to get the land back that was taken.
Well, that is true. In Canada, there's been an enormous pushback, hasn't there?
And I think that comes from Kevin Annett. Although in America, they also are. We've got UNDROP as well, which nobody's said much about, which is the United Nations. It took 20 years to get that through the UN, because the USA and UK were actively trying to block it all the way down. I wonder why.
The usual suspects.
Yeah, completely. Completely.
The head of the snake, aren't we?
Yeah, God.
Anyway, look, why Albion? I mean, Albion, it sounds like some sort of kind of nostalgia trip, really.
Well, yeah, but that's it, isn't it? It's from the days before we had all of this empirical.
And it seems to me that the financial system is basically trying to replace what we had before, which was a system of land.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, I suppose much of this is from the enclosures, where you had people, maybe Mate Martin, if you want to chip in here, do feel free, and you're quite good on all this history. But the idea was that, to begin with, people, money wasn't really a thing, and in the local manors, people used to go and serve the Lord of the Manor, either working on his land or go and fight for the Lord of the Manor. Now it seems that all of that interaction is done through money. People are paying for this and paying for that.
Well, I mean, that's the transition from feudalism to capitalism that you're describing there. And, of course, you know, people did have rights in the communities that they were born into, but you had to be born into that community. And, you know, other outsiders weren't allowed into that community. And, of course, actually, at the end of the day, serfs were serfs. They belonged to the Lord of the Manor. And in Poland, they used to say, the land is ours, we are yours. Speaking of the landlords, we are yours, we are your serfs, but the land is ours. Yeah.
So it sounds to me like you're saying there was tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people that didn't have anything.
Well, I mean, this is the way, I mean, you know, obviously, as enclosures led to, you know, a monetized economy, which then was the purpose, you know, which then led to the industrial takeoff and all the rest of it.
Those, the housing, I always remember reading about this thing, the copyhold, because we now have leasehold and freehold. Back in those days, most land was held by copyhold, and that was simply passed on to the family. So it would be someone in the same family. It wouldn't be any good as collateral against a loan, because it couldn't be sold by a bank on the open market. It could only go to somebody in your family.
Yes, well, I mean, obviously, the relationships between peasants or farmers and their landlords varied in different places
over
time. So
getting rid of the copyhold, in a way, was like marketizing it all.
Well, that's right. I mean, Britain was the first country which made a proper free market in land.
Ooh, proper free market.
Well, I mean, just saying.
Yeah, we were the first to go for mass urbanisation.
That's right. I mean, we were the first country where more people lived in towns and cities than on the land.
That was
In China, that's only happened relatively recently.
That was enclosure and industrial revolution.
Yeah. It was, but there was also the Romans who arrived and made us give them a percentage at least of what we grew, if not money, and took away women's rights after Boudicca. So we for 2,000 years didn't have any rights anyway as females.
Really?
Women, yeah.
Well, I think you had some rights. Mm. But, I mean, no, you're right. I think there was...
Women didn't get the vote in this country until the 1920s.
Well, no, they didn't.
That's exactly it.
And wasn't it that women couldn't own property?
We used to be able to. It was a matriarchal society, and we were seen as equal. I mean, Queen Boudicca could lead the army. You know, we had the exact same rights. And when we talk about the settlements, you know, each was unique and had handcrafted goods, and you traded your food and your goods. And, yeah, OK, they may have had the odd skirmish, but I think, you know... Ultimately, that was a far better system than what we got now, isn't it?
The odd skirmish.
Yeah, the odd skirmish, you know.
Well, yeah,
there's plenty of skirmishing going on.
Have your house burnt there in the middle of the night.
Well, you could move. You were allowed to move. You were free to move. You could follow the sun, you know.
Well, I'm not sure, because pretty much everything was pretty tribal in those days. There were pretty strict boundaries, weren't there?
Were they? I mean, I know in America they definitely were free to move as they needed to.
In a way, one of the most interesting things that we've mentioned in this little chit-chat is about Canada, because the original way that the British took the land in Canada was through God. Because they turned up and they said, well, you're all pagans and we're from God, and God owns this land, so we're taking it all over for God. Mm. And then they started buying it and selling it.
Yes.
And so in a way, what's happened with the sort of moving away from any kind of pretense of having anything to do with God is that the Native Americans have now said, right, we're having it back now.
Totally. But it wasn't just that, was it? It was a removal of indigenous wisdom. And who would have known about the next ice age and the next volcano, etc.?
You're saying that Native Americans could predict volcanoes?
I'm saying they were far more aware, because that wisdom was passed down religiously, as it were, from the elders to the young. That's how the young learnt. And you were very much dependent on the land. You had to be. So you had to know what was coming next.
I think, in a way, the most amazing thing about everything we've been saying in the last 20 minutes or so is that people don't know they're landless.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody deserves land.
Yeah,
everyone
totally.
Needs it. And yeah. So what they've done over the centuries, particularly since enclosure and the Civil War, the capitalism sort of formal takeover by these Puritans, is that you have no right anymore to even the country that you're voting in or born in. And even now, we've come a full circle to the fact where your vote doesn't really mean anything, because you were still voting for a uniparty. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see where all this goes in the future, with Andy Burnham now taking over, supposedly. So anyway, look, it's been fascinating chatting with you, Linda. Be nice to do it again sometime. We're going to go back now to the present day and to Andy Burnham. Here he is. He's done his first Prime Minister's Question Time this week, and he talked about Bristol. Let's see how he got on.
We now come to Prime Minister's Questions. Anne Davies.
Siop yn fawr, Mr Llefarydd. Question number one.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm delighted that North Somerset is finally getting two fantastic new stations at Pill and Portishead with the reopening of the railway line. But, and I hate to sound greedy, with Bristol Airport's potential expansion on the horizon, it risks becoming one of the worst connected major airports in the country. Will my right honourable friend the Prime Minister agree that now we need a proper mass transit system for North Somerset and Wecker, linking Felton, the new Woodspring development, Long Ashton and the wider economic area?
Well, I know my honourable friend worked hard on getting those new stations. People in Portishead and Pill have waited far too long for those new stations, but they're now on the way. And can I say, it does reflect what I was saying to the House yesterday, the big cities of England, and I'm talking about Leeds, talking about Bristol, they should have mass transit systems, Mr. Speaker. and I will work with the wonderful Mayor of the West of England, Helen Godwin, to make progress on that, to connect Bristol, its new arena, the station, the development of Templemead, into a mass transit system that takes Bristol forward.
Really? She's going to work with the Mayor of the West of England. Now, the Mayor of the West of England, that's a very big area, the West of England. Actually, she's just a Metro Mayor. She's not even really part of... I think it's Somerset. She's not in Somerset. She's in basically in Bath, Gloucestershire and Bristol. But anyway, he's making claims that we've heard many, many, many times. In fact, the last 25 years, mass transit in Bristol.
Well, yeah, it's aspirational, isn't it? And when it comes down to it, nothing much seems to happen. And, of course, the irony is that we used to have a very successful tram system here in Bristol, which has got rid of.
Yeah, if you go to St Mary Redcliffe Church, by the way, which is the Masonic Cathedral here in Bristol, in the back garden, it's the church, in the churchyard, you can still see a piece of tram line which was hit by in the Blitz, blew up in the air and then stuck in the ground and they couldn't get it out. So, the trams were all over the place in Bristol, even running up Park Street, which is extremely... Actually, I think they went up Park Row, not up Park Street itself. So it was like...
Sir George White who developed it all.
That's right.
And, of course, what happened after the war is the mighty motor car took over and they ripped it all out. Many East European cities have got quite successful
trams. Yeah, of course, the British
trams.
Transport Commission got rid of the trams.
Yeah.
They said that the trams caused congestion because they couldn't get, these posh people couldn't get through in their cars. The tram was in the way.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, the problem is path dependency. You know, once you've made a decision, a poor decision like selling off council houses or getting rid of trams, it takes you eight, you know, you can't just rewind the video and redo it. So you're then in a suboptimal position and you're actually trying to do things, you know, from a suboptimal position. But I mean, I think one of the things that may happen is there's going to be a massive crash. And of course, that will cause lots of misery and unemployment and all the rest of it. But it will certainly reduce things like CO2. That's what happened during the transition crash in the Soviet Union. All of these factories closed and loads of people put out of work. But in actual fact, the ecological damage that was being done was fairly quickly. You know, there's a big decrease in CO2 emissions during that era.
Well, as people start dying and rotting, then the methane will increase, and that's far worse than CO2.
I know. I mean, I think what I think is going to happen is we're going to have a major economic crisis, probably worse than the 1930s. And of course, that's a terrible thing to have to contemplate.
Well, we were hearing last week, weren't we?
That's when things might change.
Catherine Austin Fitz last week that there's already a new system prepared called Stablecoin, and a whole new bunch of data centres which are going to be used to manage people and manage that new financial system. Seems to me that's something like.
Yeah,
anyway, look, let's carry on with Prime Minister's questions. He's also talking this week about employment. You know, are there any jobs for young people?
Danny Kruger. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I applaud the Prime Minister's focus on civil society and on support for young people, but the fact is that in his time as Mayor of Greater Manchester, youth employment there did not improve. In fact, it got worse. And no amount of taxpayer-funded support is going to fix that. So will the Prime Minister accept that the way to get young people into work is to provide meaningful tax cuts for businesses and also to ensure that people who can work should be working?
Yeah. Well, I indicated that earlier today, Mr. Speaker, that young people who can work should be working. I believe they want to work. The question is, have we always given them the support that they need? As Mayor of Greater Manchester, proudly, I delivered a huge increase in the work placements attached to T levels that benefited young people. I introduced a free bus pass for 16 to 18 year olds to connect them to opportunity. And actually the rise in NEETs was not the same in Greater Manchester as in other parts of the country. So we might want to go back and check that. On this issue, let's work to get the best possible package we can to support our young people. It is too hard growing up as it is at this moment in time. We can make it better if we do it as a cross-party, with cross-party support. That's the best message we could send to the next generation.
So That is what he's saying there, which I thought was quite interesting. Danny Kruger, I'm talking about here, he's a Reform UK MP. Is he saying actually what we need to do is tax cuts for business that will help employment? Well, I'm not so sure it will, because quite a lot of these companies are slowly employing less people as they bring in AI, which seems to be designed into the system. So is there a way, Martin, from an economics point of view and a Labour Party Marxist socialist point of view, to try to actually get more stable employment, more opportunities for youngsters?
Well, I mean, what Danny Crew was saying is just let the market, you know, cut taxes on businesses like that my friends run, and then they'll put people to work, and that's the solution. We've been trying that solution since 1980.
It doesn't work, does it?
It doesn't work. What you actually have to do is what we did in the 1950s, which is you've got to have, you know, you've got to invest in young people. You've got to train them up. You've got to give them apprenticeships.
And what about public sector, massive public sector employment for public work?
Well, that's right. I mean, the obvious thing to do, if we do have a big crash, is you reboot the economy by doing lots of stuff that needs doing anyway. Keynes always argued that you should have a load of infrastructure projects and other things like that ready to go, so that as soon as the economy starts to go down, the government
If it's ready to go, you should do it before the economy starts to go down.
Yeah, but the problem is that the capitalist class will not allow that to happen until they're on the back foot. And
you're talking about the bond markets here.
Well, then when we talk, the bond, all this stuff about the bond markets is overdone. The bond markets are going to crash because of the US. That's where the big crash is going to come. The Japanese yen, what they call carry trade, has just fallen apart. So that at some point, you know, what's happened with the Strait of Hormuz and all the rest of it, that's going to crash the Japanese economy. They're going to sell all of the US treasuries that they hold. That will then crash the US economy, and we will be swept away. We're a tiny little rowing boat in the middle of all of this. So there's not really any solution in Britain on its own. But of course, if the whole world goes down the drain, as what was going to happen, then what will get us out of it is having a great big 5-year plan rolling on like they do in China. And of course, the Chinese will be affected by this crash, but not anything like the way we will be, because they've got a mixed economy.
We've heard the last couple of weeks. It's interesting to have Faisal Islam on the telly starting to say this, that the bond markets are getting jittery and they're starting to charge a lot more interest to lend money to governments. They don't seem to have much confidence in the government. They think the government may be going a kind of cul-de-sac or whatever. They're not going to be able to repay their debts.
Well, that's partly because we've reduced taxes on wealthy people. In the 1950s, they had to pay taxes, properly pay taxes. That's why all these national trust properties went into the hands of the
economy. The economy is just fundamentally not working at all. But I think Peter Hitchens has been talking about this last couple of weeks as well. The economy is just not working.
Well, I mean, it's not just the British economy that's not working. Yeah. The capitalist economy globally isn't working. But of course, there is an alternative model.
The Chinese.
It's called Communist China.
The Chinese is working rather well. They've beaten us at the capitalism, and they're supposed to be communist.
It's not, because it's not really, it's actually a mixed economy. The government there has real power to do things.
Well, that's
if
the way,
they want to do
the
things, they
things,
can do them.
That's the way things used to be here, folks, in case you are a youngster and don't remember. So anyway, what about the EU? Maybe the great solution for Andy Burnham is going to rejoin the EU.
Sir Ed David, leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister said yesterday that Brexit ushered in a decade of low growth and stalled regeneration. He is right. Our economy is stuck in this mess, thanks to the Conservatives and the Leader of Reform and their terrible Brexit deal. Unless we grow the economy, there is no way we can end the cost of living crisis or cut the cost of borrowing for the government. The answer is staring him in the face. Join the single market, get a new deal with Europe, and cut costs for families, businesses and government. It's the bold step our country desperately needs. Will the Prime Minister take it?
Well, can I thank the Right Honourable gentleman, and I think he is absolutely right to share the analysis that I laid out yesterday. It's clear. The growth, the low growth we've had, the decade of low growth, has been partly a result of Brexit. And the sooner the party opposite accepts that, the more we can start to face up to Britain's future and where do we go from here. I do want a closer relationship. I will build on the work of my predecessor. There are issues facing British farming right now, and there are issues facing British steel right now. And the Made in Europe agenda could pose significant problems for British steel. So as he will know, we are approaching a UK-EU summit in the next couple of months. It is imperative, I believe, that we work hard to get a good deal for British steel, for British farming, as part of that new deal that he talks about.
So this Made in EU policy from Brussels, Martin, it could be a bit of a problem, couldn't it? Because we're not in the EU anymore.
Well, that's right. I mean, of course, you know, I mean, Ed Davey's going to say that because the Liberal Democrats were opposed to Brexit. And if you look at the opinion polls, you'll see most people in the country have concluded that Brexit basically has been wrong. I mean, it's not been a complete disaster, but there's been nothing positive from it.
The thing is, Germany's still in the EU and it's having all sorts of similar problems to Britain.
That's right, because the Americans blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is much more important.
So maybe it's nothing to do with Brexit. Maybe it's to do with the Americans blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline.
That's right. I mean, maybe we need to get out of NATO and stop spending all this money on bombing Iran.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because NATO and the EU have been in bed together this week talking about how terrible and dangerous Russia is. But we'll be having that after the break. I think we should really, though, before we get your verdict on how you think Andy Burnham is performing in his role, we should have a listen to his confrontation with the supposed leader of the opposition, Kerry Badenoch, even though they're very low in the polls from the public, that's what they officially are.
Mr. Speaker, he is the Prime Minister now. He needs to answer the questions instead of spending time attacking someone who has more private sector experience than his entire cabinet. Him whether he would rule out more borrowing. He did not do so. We spend more servicing our debt than we do on defence, almost double. There is war in Europe, Mr. Speaker. Yesterday, Germany confirmed that Russia was behind the attack on Leipzig Airport. Tensions are so high, the director of the CIA flew to Moscow. We need the plan to hit 3% on defence now. But the armed forces won't know what they'll be getting until next July's spending review. There is a simple answer to this. Cut welfare spending and invest that money in our defence. Mr. Speaker, the honeymoon is over. Isn't it time for the Prime Minister to ditch the vibes and get serious about defending our nation?
Well, can I start with the serious point that she made, Mr. Speaker, and that was the announcement by the German government yesterday in relation to the attack in Leipzig, and I think that should unite the House in sending complete condemnation of that attack by Russia and complete solidarity in this House to support both Germany and to support Ukraine, and that position will not change. And it takes me to defence. The very reason I appointed this Chancellor to his position is because of his strong commitment to the defence of our country and to defence spending. We will fully fund the defence investment plan, and at the spending review we will set out a plan to meet our NATO commitments by 2035. There is no problem with our commitment to defence, Mr. Speaker. But more broadly, the Honourable Lady has made a lot of accusations there about what went wrong. But I go back to what was the position that she left. The country was not heading in the right direction. Now we are heading in the right direction. Yesterday I laid out a clear, coherent, credible plan for growth based on 10 years of delivering it myself. This is grounded in reality. I want to take it to all parts of the country, and it's all about bringing back a sense of positivity, Mr. Speaker, a sense of possibility, growth in every postcode. Let this country believe in itself again. Let people have some hope. And that is what this government will do.
So is he right to be so positive there, Martin, or is this kind of what they call toxic positivity, where actually he's just talking it up and actually there's nothing really going to change?
Well, the problem is that nobody's facing up to the fact there's about to be a collapse in the AI bubble, which will smash all of the financial services sector, the bond market, all the rest of it is going to go down the drain. Kemi Badenoch doesn't have a clue about any of this. And what I would say to her is, if she wants to have a war with Russia, poor people shouldn't have to pay for it. If she's serious about wanting war with Russia, and we shouldn't have a war with Russia, it's all nonsense, but if you're serious about that, people like Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage need to pay a lot more taxes, like they did in the 1950s, when the glorious Gloucesters were fighting the Chinese army on the Indian River, and the top rate of tax in this country was 95%. That's what going to war means. It means rationing as well, of course. In the Korean War, there was rationing, food rationing. Is Kemi Badenoch prepared to just have three sausages a week to have a war with Russia? She's not. They're none of them talking seriously. And of course, even if we spent the money that they're saying we're going to spend, it would not produce weaponry which is of any use whatsoever in the war that we're now in. Because it's already on. We haven't got any hypersonic weaponry. We won't have any for at least 20 years. The Russians and the Iranians are armed to the teeth with that stuff. So even if we decided to fight with them, we couldn't win.
Well, it's interesting, so it's because you're talking about this AI bubble. Steve Keen, the economist, has been mentioning this week.
Schumpeter's argument was the boom begins with some technological advance, which means that the company that creates that technology gets a lead over all the others, but it's got to invest to get there. The investment stage causes a boom. Then when the product starts rolling out, it undercuts existing industries and causes a slump. And then in that stage, the technology becomes integrated into society overall. That's the basic pattern. Now, with AI, it looks like the scale of investment compared to the potential revenue streams is wrong by a factor of at least about 10. When you look at the costs of AI companies versus the revenues, you're often looking at a ratio of 10 to 1. So they're making losses now, and the belief is they'll make profits in the future. But just like that happened with the internet bubble, the expectations of profit were far larger than the sector could actually sustain. We're still about to see that break come through. There's also the wild card of what will happen if China produces a cheaper version of AI than America can manage. That seems to be a large part of the focus of the Chinese, is to make it use less energy and be cheaper, and you know, be running AI on your own computer rather than needing a data center. They may have a slump. The overinvestment boom might be followed for a slump where all those investments become obviously worthless because the Chinese don't need the data centers on the same scale the Americans do. It may be Chinese companies that dominate AI. The remaining Americans don't make anything like the revenue they expect. So we're in for, a fascinating period. We're starting to see this turning up already in the price that's being charged for the tokens that are part of an AI system. At the moment, that price is well below the cost of using the energy in those data centers that perform the calculations for you. At some point, those prices are going to go up. The number of people using AI will fall fairly dramatically, and AI will then be focused just in the industries where it does things that we really can't do any other way. But before the period of the slump in AI actually starts, but that's the outcome I expect. So we're going to get a slump out of AI. It's still going to have an impact and permeate through society, but nowhere near as widely as most of the AI advocates thought. They're not making revenue out of it, but they're letting people, you know, create cartoons using AI and charging them one-tenth of the cost effectively to make the cartoons. Well, the cartoons are going to go. There will still be serious uses for AI, and it will settle down into those uses, but it might be one-tenth the scale of the economic impact that people originally thought it would have because they've invested 10 times as much as they should have. Well, the warning indicators in terms of the slump we're about to face are the Strait of Hormuz and when the oil stocks start running out. So one of the reasons that oil prices didn't rise as much as people thought they would initially is that China has reserves of the order of 1.5 billion barrels of oil. So America has a strategic reserve measured in millions of barrels, and China's got them measured in billions of barrels. So by running down its stock, it actually suppressed the increase in price caused by the cutoff in supplies that has already occurred. But they're now restocking They're now back in restocking that particular, building up the stock that they ran down to do that early. Neoclassical theory will tell you markets are forward-looking. Well, BS to that. They tend to react to the spot market dynamics, and because of China's running down of its reserves and the same of America, there hasn't been much of an increase in the oil prices. When the stocks run out and the flow of supply is also cut off because of the cutting of the Strait of Hormuz, then we're going to have a dramatic fall in the availability of oil, and that will then affect production processes all across the globe. It'll make, obviously, the oil price will rise, but the main thing is there simply won't be the availability of oil to sustain the level of economic activity. And this is one of the areas where the mainstream is completely wrong, because they don't realise the role of energy in production. Now, that might sound crazy to you if you're not an economist, and frankly, it is crazy, because when you take a look at the relationship between energy and GDP, it's virtually a one-for-one relationship.
So that's Professor Steve Keane, one of our faves on this show. I remember he did a thing about the euro being a suicide pact, which did very, very well. Lots of people on YouTube shared that around the world. But he's there looking at two markets. One is oil, the other is AI.
Yeah, I mean, and the interaction between the two of them is going to create, Michael Hudson, for example, thinks we're going to have a global depression. It's not a recession, a depression. And that is going to cause all kinds of problems and difficulties for everybody.
Well, so what he's saying there, in a nutshell, talking about AI, which I thought was quite interesting, he's saying, well, as AI is in its initial stages, and it's basically a loss leader, so they're losing loads of money on it, what is going to be the effect of that is people are going to be using AI, it's really cheap, and various industries are going to collapse as a result because people are using AI instead. And then once those alternative industries, whatever they may be, whether it's to do with robotics even journalism, right? So then they jack the price up when the alternative's gone. And this is one of the main, it seems to me, missions of AI, is to destroy as many industries as it can, and then once those industries are dead, to quadruple or multiply by 10 the amount you have to pay to use the AI.
Well, that would be the evil plan behind it in the minds of the people who are doing it. But the problem they've got is that the Chinese have, in fact, produced AI much cheaper.
Oh, dear.
And, of course, that will actually, I mean, in itself, will break the AI bubble. And, of course, the Chinese have developed, I mean, Warwick Powell, who's another Aussie economist who I follow quite closely, he's very, he's very knowledgeable about what's going on in China. And, of course, they've seen all this coming miles off. They actually have a plan, not just a 5-year plan, a 15-year plan. We don't bother with things like that. We just have prime minister's questions and everybody just mouths off.
So how do you think Andy Burnham's done with his PMQs? Is he any different?
Well, I mean, he's not messed up. But, of course, the problem is that nobody is talking about the serious stuff. You know, Kemi Badenoch saying that the solution is to cut welfare spending. It's ludicrous. A lot of these people who are on welfare are unemployable. Employers don't want to employ them. So are you going to make the employers employ them? How are you going to make them do that? When they've got but they can't make a profit out of it. They're not going to do it, are they? So you actually, because of what's happened, lots of, you know, all of the boom and bust that we've been through in this country, and it's, you know, we are famous for it, is you've created a whole dead weight of people who are actually not able to contribute very much at all. And it would be nice if they could, but they're not going to. Now, you could actually execute them all, otherwise you're going to have to pay them some benefits. And, of course, the real, real expense is things like having Diego Garcia and Akrotiri and bailing the banks out and all the others. You know, but people, as Linda was saying earlier, people have forgotten that we bailed the banks out. If you're going to follow a free market textbook, then the banks should have been allowed to fail, which means that people like Nigel Farage lose all their money apart from 30 grand. But they didn't want to do that. And then, of course, they're now telling us what we can and can't do. And they've got experience in the private sector, all the rest of it. If the banks had been allowed to go bust, Farage would be down at the job centre.
Well, one person who's been really putting quite a lot of oomph behind it, the same sort of things we say, really, which is that things are far worse than the media has been telling us. And also, the government is not prepared, is a chap called Peter Hitchens. And this week he did what he called an obituary for Britain.
happen. I'm often accused of defeatism, and I say, well, as I understand it, defeatism is a belief that you should embrace defeat and hurry it on, that you actually desire it. It was the revolutionary defeatism of the Bolsheviks. They wanted Russia to lose the war with Germany because they believed it would help them bring about the revolution. But I get accused of being defeatist because I say, we have been defeated. I didn't want to be defeated, and I would say, if challenged, that I nearly reduced myself to tears during the period about 2008 to 2010, trying to warn people of the disastrous results of David Cameron succeeding in taking over the Conservative Party on behalf of the Blairites. I lost friends. I lost huge amounts of sleep. I had to take part in embarrassing debates where I was the only person in the room who was saying what I was saying, and nobody would pay any attention. It was like a nightmare. And it made me very distressed. At the end of it, I thought, well, I've had enough of that. It certainly made me unhappy. It didn't work. And from now on, I will simply comment upon things as they are. And I'm now accused of having contributed to it. I absolutely rebut that. I did everything that was in my power as a national newspaper columnist, which isn't very much power, but it's some. I even approached other people in my position to try and get them to help me do it, and none of them would. I did everything in my power to avert it, and I couldn't avert it, and so now it's happened. In fact, that was the moment at which the trap closed. In my first book, The Abolition of Britain, I quoted, as I often do, the editor of Oz in the 1960s, Richard Neville. He's a very clever man, and he said, it's always stuck in my mind, there is an inch of difference between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, but it is in that inch of difference that we all live. And the result of the Blairisation of the Conservative Party under Cameron was that inch closed. And one of the main features of life since the Cameron takeover has been an almost total collapse of true freedom of speech and thought. And if, for instance, like me, you think that it's not in Britain's national interest to pursue war with Russia, then basically you're treated as a traitor. There is no room for debate about this, whereas all the previous conflicts and troubles of the post-war period from Suez to Vietnam, it was perfectly legitimate for people who were patriots to say that they opposed these things, and they weren't dismissed as traitors or told they were Lord Haw-Haw or pumping out Russian propaganda, which I would never dream of doing. Now you are, and it's quite, anybody who can think will find themselves very rapidly on the dangerous edge of things. Well, that's all right in a free society. But in a society which has almost entirely forgotten how to be free and doesn't much want to be, it becomes increasingly alarming.
Many listeners will recall some of the stuff you wrote during the lockdown mania. You were on my podcast in that moment talking about some of the lockdown stuff. And that was another example of an era when there were certain things you couldn't say. And if you said them, you were in big trouble.
Well, I was accused of killing my own readers. And the things on one occasion, I was actually specifically accused of helping to bring about the death of an individual who I'd never met or heard of. It was extraordinary. I don't know what the word really is for it, but it was Salem comes to Britain in many ways, and it was any lingering beliefs that I'd had that the British people had a special desire for liberty and a special readiness to stand up to authority were almost wholly dispelled by that. And so this is another thing about the use of what I do or say. Every few days, as it happens, somebody will approach me in Marks and Spencer's or on the street and say, I really wanted to say how grateful I am for what you said during what they still tend to call the lockdown, now called the panic. And I understand what they're saying. They were really, really concerned that there was no other voice, that they were thinking something, and they were beginning to think they'd gone crazy because no one was saying anything publicly in opposition to it. And by opposing it, I, at the least, I gave them some comfort. And that's, it's, to me, I'm always very pleased when they say, because they really mean it. And it obviously did make a difference. And imagine being in such a circumstance and there being no voice against it. So it is worth it, but it doesn't achieve anything material.
Okay, speaking of the British people, you said that the panic was the moment, the COVID era was the moment when you lost the last bit.
No. That was a confirmation. It was the crucial moment was when the electorate, including many patriotic conservatives, voted for the Cameron take over of the Conservative Party in the 2010 election. They didn't actually give him a majority, but alas, most people have forgotten that, and he did come into government and the endorsement happened. But it was the key moment at which the trap closed. After that, there really hasn't been any freedom or any true free debate in this country. Interestingly, one of the most important things Cameron did, which almost everybody forgets, and Blair is universally excoriated for the Iraq war, and rightly so. But Cameron gets a free pass for the Libyan war, which was in so many ways a catastrophe of stupidity and with disastrous outcomes for the whole of Europe, unforgivably. But it was war where it made itself felt most of all. There's this extraordinary desire in parts of the British establishment to go to war with various people.
There's Peter Hitchens, Martin, pointing out that actually this is a Tory thing as much as it was a Blairy thing.
Well, I mean, he's right to point out the attack on Libya as being absolutely ludicrous. I mean, that's the main cause of the refugee crisis, which has been engulfing Europe. And of course, the destruction of Syria, where Al-Qaeda are now in power in Syria.
What about this
with
idea
your taxes,
of,
folks? You paid for that.
What about this idea of it being a tradition to be an independent minds when Britain goes, no, but that's all gone with Russia? We know, of course,
well, I mean,
if you're against Russia, if you're not against Russia, then you're a traitor.
Well, I think Peter Hitchens, I mean, some of the things he says I agree with. Other things I don't agree with. But
isn't it true for you and I too?
Well, it's true of anybody.
Isn't it true of anybody?
Yeah.
Peter Hitchens has got his national newspaper column, and he's now saying, "Well, the country's had it mainly because what he's pointing out in this piece is the lack of free speech and the lack of debate and discussion. There is this dictatorial attitude now where this is going to be the great new wonderful thing, and we're going to do it. And if anyone questions it, then maybe you may even have your collar felt."
Well, as we know, there are quite a number of Palestine Action prisoners in our prisons, and hundreds and thousands of people now have been arrested for speaking out about that. And I'm not quite sure what Peter Hitchens' position is on that, but a lot of people on the right, the reform people, go on about freedom of speech, but they all voted to ban Palestine Action.
Peter Hitchens is absolutely clear about the banning of Palestine Action, and the idea that you're not allowed to speak in support of it is abhorrent.
Well, that's good. I'm not convinced about the stuff about lockdowns, but that's a different issue.
Mm.
Yeah, let's not mix these things up.
You can't actually ever have a democracy without debate. I think that's the thing he's pointing out. Really,
well, that's right. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with him about everything, but he's got a right to say it. And I think, of course, because he's got an audience on the right of British politics, he can say stuff that nobody on the left dares to say. I mean, in actual fact, we should never have gone to war with Russia. There's no reason for it whatsoever.
Have we gone to war with
Russia? Yes, we have. We've been killing, it was probably British drones which killed all these teenage girls in this dormitory a couple of months ago. But it's not been on our media at all, has it? It's been all over the media in Russia.
Who decided we were going to have a war with Russia then? Who?
It's the US deep state, because they want to conquer the world. I mean, it's full spectrum dominance.
Wasn't it Victoria Nuland? I think it's her.
Well, she was the person who
was
in Kiev at the time.
She was funding the coup.
That's right.
in Kiev.
Yes, of course. And of course, you know, we are actually in a war already with Russia. If there's about to be an election in Russia on September the 18th to the 21st, it's coming up. And one of the main issues in that election is, why don't we start killing some British service personnel? We've lost 100,000 of our guys. They're bombing.
They reckon around about 3 million Ukrainians are dead.
Well, that's right. It's a horrendous, and none of it was necessary. They could easily have
all of those.
They could easily
all
have been
of those
avoided.
Because of Boris Johnson.
Well, it's partly because of Boris Johnson.
Well, those 3 million
yep.
100,000 dead.
There was a peace deal on the table to go.
This is
at
Minsk,
Istanbul.
Yeah.
No,
Istanbul.
Yeah, there have been several missed opportunities here. There shouldn't have been a coup in the first place.
Anyway, we're going to be talking about that after the break. So let's have a bit of a break now, and we'll return to looking at the fight between two different parts of the Ukrainian secret services after this.
the same when you open the veins. And sometimes it was fate, power, or reason as the cornerstone, but the furrow brow has never left his face. Somewhere.
Ian McCulloch there from, I think he's from Echo and the Bunnymen. Finally, back in 1983, I think that was. Yes, that's called the September Song. It's had lots of different versions of that. The Mafia guy Sinatra did one as well, I think, as well. But I like that one. Then before that, you've got Is It Like Today, 1993, from World Party. And at the very start, it's quite a stirring little tune from Wishbone Ash, the little band from, I don't think either of them actually came from Torquay, but they were formed in Torquay. The King Will Come, from the 1972 album Argus, A-R-G-U-S. So welcome back to the Bristol Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. It's a September is the time of year for war. It's also a little bit depressing, isn't it, where the days start lengthening, Martin?
Yeah, and of course, big stock market crashes happen in September and October, don't they?
War as well?
Well, don't forget, World War One and World War Two broke out in August and started to be fighting in September. Yeah.
So, World War Three?
Well,
we love peddling doom and gloom.
Well, that's right. This is doom and gloom.
But it is a little bit. I mean, the thing is, you're right about this time of year. But I mean, at the end of the day, it's just a cycle, and you shouldn't really be getting depressed because it's. But you can't help it, can you? Really, especially after we've had such a lovely summer with all that marvelous heat. You know, I managed to get swimming a good few times out in the sun. Now, of course, it's going back to cold, short days, long hours. Of course, you can't. It hits you on a sort of subconscious level. Is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I'm afraid the seasons have been rolling by for many millennia, and it's not really, you know, really, it's not, that's going to, I mean, obviously the questions about climate that we were discussing earlier, this is undoubtedly the biggest crisis since World War II.
What is?
But the one we're living through.
What crisis?
Oh, there's no crisis, no.
No, but what's the heart of it?
Well, the heart of it is the capitalist, late capitalism becoming absolutely predatory.
Anyway, this week we had a I think, extraordinary press conference in Brussels with Ursula von der Leyen, the President of Europe, she likes to think, and Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, both absolutely condemning the Russians for attacking Leipzig.
For some time, the German government has been saying that it believed a state actor was behind the incident involving drones at Leipzig airport. Then over the course of the weekend into this week, the suggestion was that it would be naming Russia as being responsible. Now, the foreign minister and interior minister have done so. This is what they had to say.
The Russian consulate general in Bonn will be closed on 18 September. The lease for the Russian house in Berlin will be terminated. We will propose new listings of individuals from Russia within the EU in the context of hybrid attacks. We are tightening entry controls for Russian nationals. We are increasing the pressure on the Russian shadow fleet.
Which means that this institution, the Russian House of Science and Culture, will be closed. There's been one of these since 1984. Back then it was the Soviet House of Science and Culture. What does it all mean, though? Well, take note of the fact that Friedrich Merz was not the person announcing this decision to close the Consulate General, to close this Russia House. They did not decide to expel diplomats. So in effect, they could have done much more. What this is a clear demonstration to Russia that Germany is serious. And it's also a demonstration to the EU that Germany wants the EU to act. Dominic Kane, Al Jazeera, Berlin.
Yeah, Al Jazeera have been pretty good on this. But, I mean, this is all due to a drone in Leipzig. They're kicking out the Russian cultural presence.
Well, I mean, the Leipzig drone strikes me entirely. I mean, this is what the Russians are saying. It's a false flag attack. if the Russians wanted a drone.
Do you know what actually happened? And what, you know, there was a drone.
A drone
was found with explosives at Leipzig. Yeah. And there, my understanding of the Russians is if they want to hit you with a drone, they're going to do it.
Well, that's what various people have pointed out. They're the masters of drone warfare. So this one, there was a drone that didn't, you know, the three drones found weren't there, I think. And, you know, why would they want to, you know, the Russians at some point will decide, they may well decide to attack military infrastructure in Western Europe. But if they do, it'll be overwhelming. There won't be just a couple of drone attacks.
Well, this wasn't actually a drone attack.
No,
nothing happened. A drone found with some explosives. Yes.
Don't forget, they've got an election coming up in Saxony, which AfD look as if they're going to win,
yeah.
And the mainstream parties are desperate to whip up anti-Russian.
You know
feeling
what? It's funny. You remind me of the 2017 election here, when we had a general election and there was an attempt to. In fact, we had terrorist attacks before that election, and they were all saying, "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn is a terrorist. Don't vote for him."
That's right. And the same thing happened in Madrid with the Madrid train bombings before the election there, but it misfired because, in actual fact, the population in Spain, a lot of the younger population and the poorer population came out to vote, and they voted for Zapatero, who is actually under investigation as we speak.
So this could just be a come on, this silly drone.
Well, I'm just presuming that it is. It's what this is about is brainwashing the German electorate and the British electorate.
What about
the Russians? The Russians just roll their eyes. You know, why do you imagine we would do something
like that?
Well,
they did bother to deny it. But anyway, so let's have a listen now to Ursula von der Leyen, as I promised you earlier. The dulcet tones of the lady who I met, well, I didn't actually meet her, saw her, at the Bilderberg conference in Dresden in 2016. And we heard from the staff that she had been at the top table sitting right next to Henry Kissinger. Anyway, she's now the President of Europe. And this is what she had to say about Russian drones.
So, good afternoon. Dear markets, always a pleasure to welcome you here. We meet today to discuss Russia's attack in Leipzig. The German government has identified Russia as behind an attempt to attack cargo planes at Leipzig-Halle Airport. Had this attack succeeded, this would have resulted in enormous damage and possibly even loss of life. So I want to be very clear about what this was. This was an attack using military-grade material carried out by Russian operatives on European Union soil. We will not tolerate it. We stand in full solidarity with Germany. And if the intention was to make us think twice about supporting Ukraine, I can tell you it has only strengthened my resolve. Intimidation will not work, and this is why I'm meeting with NATO's Secretary General today. We are united. Europe and NATO will not just maintain our pressure on Russia, we will increase it, and we will not stop. Not until Russia stops bombing and killing innocent children, men and women in Ukraine. Leipzig marks a new escalation on European Union soil, directly attributed to Russia. But it is part of a broader pattern of increasingly dangerous incidents, repeated incursions in our airspace, drones that paralyze our airports, interference with our critical infrastructure. Europeans are faced with the hard truth that this is the new normal. We have to step up. And that means being ready to respond to Russia's recklessness faster and better. We must treat our everyday infrastructure as frontline targets and protect them accordingly. And we will support any member state Russia targets. Europe has already rapid response teams which can respond to these style of attacks, whether they occur inside or outside our union. So our strength, our preparedness and our resolve is our deterrence. We also do this by using the power of our single market. Our sanctions have weakened Russia's economy. We can use more sanctions and have them ready to impose as soon as such dangerous, life-threatening acts are attributed. every loophole Russia exploits is one we must close. And in Ireland today, European Foreign Affairs ministers are discussing new listings. And the Commission, we're looking at ways to cut deeper into Russia's war chest. My second point today regards our support for Ukraine. Today I can confirm that we have received a new payment request. It is worth several billion euros and would cover Ukraine's air defenses, including the highly advanced PAC-3 Patriot air defense systems. Member states are currently looking at Ukraine's request, but I can say that it's going in the right direction.
Okay, let's start with a final point there about the money. Apparently, the money is not going to go through because Ukraine is too corrupt.
Well, I mean, they're promising money, but the various governments in Europe, including our own, haven't got any money. That's why we've got the bond markets breathing down our necks.
What I'm saying is, over in Ukraine, there is a serious problem with corruption.
Well, there always has been. Ukraine is always a very corrupt place.
Meeting the EU's requirements for making sure that this money just doesn't go into people's pockets.
Well, it's also, of course, the weaponry that's being supplied is then being sold on into the black market and so on. It's a black hole.
Are sanctions working against the Russians, as she says then?
No, they're not. In fact, the sanctions on Russia, as Michael Hudson points out, were actually very positive for the Russians. They lost $300 billion worth of their assets. But, of course, they got out of the system where Russia, for example, has hardly any debt at all. Yeah, they paid off all their debts. They're in a far better position than Germany, for example.
Right, so the German leader of Europe, I find it quite ironic that she says, we stand in full solidarity with Germany.
Well, that's because she's speaking it with her EU hat on, isn't she?
Well, supposedly. I mean, we stand, you stand. I mean, it just sounds like the Germans are running the show, really. But what about this? Also, she's talking about these rapid response teams. The idea is we're going to be expecting hits on our infrastructure. So she doesn't seem to care too much about that.
Well, I mean, inside Russia itself, there have been lots of attacks on infrastructure and civilian targets, like the Crocus Theatre, where over 100 people were gunned down by so-called Islamist terrorists who are actually working for the SPU.
Well, on oil refineries, on railways, this has been happening for a year or so.
That's right, yes, and top generals have all been assassinated. None of this is... And, of course, the Russians are under attack. They are literally under attack because all sorts of things are being fired at them. Bombs are going off, people are being assassinated.
Wildberries is not exactly a military target, is it?
No, but of course the answer to that from the Russians has been they've just wiped out all warehouses in
what she's saying is at some point we expect the Russians to do to us what we've been doing to them.
Well, that's exactly... The Russians actually...
So why don't you just stop doing it to them?
Well, that's a very good question, Tony. I think the reason is that the deep state in the US wants basically Europe, including Britain, has been sacrificed. We are going to be sacrificed to keep the Russians tied down while the US concentrates on trying to start a war with China. I mean, it's bonkers, but these people aren't rational.
And Iran.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right. So, in other words...
So, they divvied up these tasks.
The EU has just become a factotum for NATO. Yeah. Not all EU countries are in NATO. Ireland isn't, for example. But nevertheless, the EU and NATO are now bound at the hip, and that's what we're doing. And, of course,
is Austria in NATO?
They can't be in NATO because at the end of the war, the Russians withdrew from Austria on the understanding that it would remain a neutral country because they were in occupation. Yeah. So that they were, but of course it doesn't really matter. The Austrian establishment, even though that's true,
Sweden
is now part of NATO. Yeah.
Fascinating. So I didn't know that. The Russians gave Austria to the West.
They withdrew on the understanding that Austria would not become. Would remain a neutral country.
Yeah.
Now, of course, at some point, Austria can say that we're not going to do that
anymore.
We've had
enough of that, and I imagine they will at some point.
At some point, they might. But on the other hand, they actually quite like, you know, I mean, I think some Austrians quite like the idea that we're not directly involved in things, like the Swiss.
We'll be hearing in a minute from Steve Jeremy, I think his name is, about there are obviously some serious doubts about what von der Leyen is saying and planning for a war. Within the establishment here in the UK. But one of the big incidents this week was the gunfight in Kiev between the SBU and the GUR. I'd never heard of the GUR. What did you make of that, Martin?
Well, obviously, it's hard to know from this distance what exactly is going on here. But, I mean, don't
it's like it's right here, for example, say MI5 having a gun battle in outside Thames House with MI6.
Well, at one stage during Northern Ireland, MI5 were grassing up MI6's agents and getting them killed by the IRA and vice versa. Yeah, these turf wars are fairly, you know, they happen all over the place.
OK, well, let's have a listen now to the BBC reporting of this extraordinary episode. I think it was early hours of Wednesday morning, where these two branches of the secret services in Ukraine started shooting at each other.
There have been extraordinary scenes in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, where members of two intelligence agencies opened fire on each other. No lives were lost, but one person was seriously injured. President Zelensky has given the chiefs of both organisations a serious dressing down. From Kyiv, our diplomatic correspondent James Landale sent this report.
Gunfire on the streets of Kyiv in the early hours of this morning. But this was no Russian attack. Instead, a sustained exchange of fire between Ukrainian state officials, apparently members of rival intelligence agencies. On one side, the so-called SBU, Ukraine's security service, broadly equivalent to MI5. On the other, a body called GUR, Ukraine's military intelligence. What happened and why is unclear and disputed, but it appears to centre on a man called Stepan Kaplunov, deputy commander of a paramilitary group of Russians who oppose President Putin and fight for Ukraine. The Russian Volunteer Corps is ostensibly controlled by GUR military intelligence, but the SBU security services reportedly detained and questioned Kaplunov. They also tried to search his apartment in eastern Kyiv, but there were members of GUR outside who allegedly blocked their way. This led to a confrontation and a firefight between both sides. Three men were reportedly injured, one seriously. An official inquiry has been opened, and a spokesman for President Zelensky said he had taken the chiefs of both agencies to task. But for Ukraine's leader and his allies, a reminder that this country may be united against Russia, but it retains institutional and political divisions that have never gone away.
So there you go. It's the GUR versus the SBU. This guy at the centre of it, Stepan Kaplunov, he's part of this volunteer corps. Apparently he's Russian, but he's sympathetic to the Ukrainians. So he's over there helping Ukraine, along with the GUR. But the SBU saying, oh no, we think he's working for the Russians.
Well, yes, and I've no idea whether what's true in that. You know, who's telling the truth here? What's clear is that the Ukrainian state is pretty dysfunctional. They've not had an election since Zelensky was elected on a peace ticket years ago. And he's
blocked, like Donald Trump.
Yes, and he's blocked any further elections. And, of course, it is quite a repressive place, Ukraine. So there are lots of political prisoners. If you speak out, you can get into all kinds of trouble. And so it's, you know, the idea that it's a beacon of democracy is laughable, frankly.
So Maria Kosareva works for RT, and I think it's only fair in terms of balance. And we know the British establishment is very anti-Russian. Let's get a Russian point of view.
Very warm welcome to you. This is RT International with the latest world news update. It's great to have you with us. Well, our top story, Vladimir Zelensky has vowed to fire the deputy heads of Ukraine's security and intelligence agencies. It's following a shootout between the rival organizations on Wednesday. That's as more details of the feud have emerged, with a Ukrainian deputy commander of a neo-Nazi unit linked to military intelligence claiming he was kidnapped by Kyiv's security services.
I, Stepan Kaplunov, was abducted by the security service of Ukraine officers on August 23rd. According to our information, for the first 3 days, I was interrogated directly by General Pokrov through the use of physical and psychological pressure. They attempted to force me to discredit deputy commander of the special unit Timur Dmitry Ivanov and Kirill Udonov in order to falsely implicate them in cooperation with the FSB. Furthermore, Baltimore. In my absence, we possess video evidence showing that SBU officers attempted to enter my residence to plant unknown items. They entered carrying large sports bags. Our side has filed an appeal with the State Bureau of Investigation to investigate this situation.
Here you basically have the SBU who snatch and detain a man they claim was working for the FSB, apparently, to kill a politician. And then they go on to release him saying, well, he confessed and cooperated, so we're letting him go, which is weird in itself. Again, and then he comes out saying, well, I was forced to say that, to confess to that by the SBU. So it's unclear what will happen to him now, because he is out there free, and now he's saying, he's done a U-turn saying all these things. But let's talk about the man of the hour, who he is to begin with. So we're talking about Stepan Kaplanov, and he is the deputy commander of the Russian Volunteer Corps. And this is considered a terrorist organization here in Russia, where as in Ukraine, it's actually a neo-Nazi unit that is within Ukraine's military intelligence. Now, the security services, the SBU, they claim that this was an FSB plot, apparently, that this man was involved to assassinate Ahmed Zakayev. Now, he's this infamous Russian opposition figure. And of course, it's Kiev who calls him a Russian opposition figure, because he's really much more than that here in Russia. He's actually been prosecuted of grave crimes. And they include, for example, murders of military personnel, law enforcement, civilians. There was even hostage taking. So this is the kind of man that Kiev proclaims to be some sort of a savior, where in fact we're talking about a criminal here, and this is the one that supposedly Kaplanov was trying to kill on behalf of Russia's FSB. He went on to confess and admit that supposedly he has contacts with the FSB and that he provided some information that led to the wider discovery of some sort of a network. And we can see actually his original confession before he made that U-turn.
A person from the territory of the Russian Federation approached me, acting in the interest of the Federal Security Service with the aim of recruiting me to perform active measures to liquidate members of the Defense Forces of Ukraine and other individuals.
And then he came out and had a completely different story, saying all of that were lies and that he was forced and psychologically pressured and blackmailed to say all of that by the SBU.
As mentioned, there was a shooting in Kyiv on Wednesday. Can you update us? What do we know about it? How did it all happen?
Well, at first, on Wednesday, we saw that in central Kyiv, videos started emerging showing the shootout. At first, it looked like two groups of soldiers aggressively approaching each other, and then shots were fired. And then we found out that actually this was the two spy groups, the two units within Ukraine's spy agencies, the GUR, as well, as we said, and the SBU, so the security services, as well as military intelligence. And again, this was over an apartment search of Stepan Kaplanov. And Kaplanov says, actually, this is an attempt by the SBU to discredit GUR, and that is how we got there. And that is why GUR showed up there as well, because they took Kaplanov and they wanted to be there and address what the hell was going on and what they were doing. And then again, shots were fired or hell broke loose. Kaplanov himself says he didn't see who fired the first shots, but we have an Ukrainian MP who claims it was an SBU agent who fired the first shot. And actually, that agent was involved in the shooting of a GUR agent back in 2022, which would be fascinating if that is indeed the case.
Ruslan Kaganets, one of the commanders of Timur unit, published a post. In it, he also mentioned the conflict between the main intelligence directorate and the security services of Ukraine back in 2022, when intelligence agent Denis Kiriev was killed in the center of Kyiv. He claims, and this is unconfirmed information, that today the State Bureau of Investigation detained three special forces officers from the 5th Directorate of Ukraine's security services, one being Alexander Bov, who allegedly fired at the intelligence officers tonight, the same person who killed Denis Kiriev in 2022. Further, what do you know about this?
Well, let's put it this way. The information you have just stated coincides with the information I have as well.
Hold on, may I clarify? It matches ours? You mean that the person who shot Kiriev in 2022 is still currently performing his duties as a part of Ukraine's security services?
We will determine that for certain, but for now, it appears so.
So we have this latest shooting, and then we have the shooting from 2022. And, you know, Marina, one thing is clear here.
the GUR and SBU have a long and difficult history against each other.
They absolutely do. And it's always been a competition. It's been a power struggle. We've seen that over the years. And this is where it really gets ridiculous, because the circus really does continue. Despite all that, we all saw the footage. We had statements coming out. Then they released a joint statement. So you have GUR and the SBU, after shooting each other, coming together, releasing a statement saying, well, we were working together to prevent an attempt by Russia's FSB to kill a politician. No mention of their confrontation whatsoever. But you have Zelensky, who did address the confrontation. Interestingly enough, he spoke about the confrontation between the two agencies and nothing about the FSB. And we know how much Zelensky would love to mention the FSB. So the fact that he's not is very interesting. Let's take a listen.
Regarding the current absolutely shameful situation that occurred in Kiev between separate units of the Security Service of Ukraine and the main Directorate of Intelligence, the Prosecutor General and the State Bureau of Investigation will find out all the details. All the testimonies and statements of the participants in this incident will be checked. The whole situation will be verified step by step. There should be responsibility, including personnel decisions by the heads of special services regarding the participants. And there should be internal investigations in both of those agencies.
So there you have it. This is the kind of mess we're talking about, the kind of mess that we see the West is continuing to sponsor and arm, most importantly of all and dangerously of all, and you have them at each other's throats.
Well, so there's the RT version. Far more detail, Martin, but is it accurate?
Well, I don't know is a simple answer. I mean, it's obviously pretty murky stuff.
So this guy's, like I say, this confrontation between these agencies took place outside the flat of Stefan Kapilov. From this volunteer corps, which is managed by the GUR, and the SBU is saying, well, actually, he's really working for the Russians. Well, and actually, what the SBU what were trying to do there was to raid, go into his flat, and it sounds like with a bomb, to kill him, actually, and to leave a bomb in there of some sort.
Well, I don't know whether that's true or not, Tony.
What, that's what they're saying, is with these big bags, and you can see the bags in the footage, you know. So the idea was, we're going to go into his flat, break in, and somehow leave these bags in there. But the GUR turned up on the scene and said, no, you're not doing that.
Yes. I mean, obviously, I don't know who's telling the truth here. I mean, both the GUR and the SBU are, frankly, reprehensible organisations. And, you know, here they are behaving in a reprehensible fashion.
But this is, I think, a fascinating little insight into the... you've got rival intelligence services within Ukraine, but then you've also got the potential role of the FSB in Russia as well, having an agent within one of those organisations.
Well, you can imagine that the FSB do everything they possibly can to get their people into positions of authority inside the Ukrainian structure. Of course they do. And no doubt the Ukrainians... Ukrainians and Russians are... You know, most Ukrainians can speak Russian. One of the things they said about the shootout was that they were swearing at each other in Russian. Because, of course, most Ukrainians can speak Russian.
But that's illegal in Ukraine.
Well, I know, but nevertheless, most Ukrainians can speak Russian. It's like, you know, in Wales, some people speak Welsh, but most people speak Welsh and English. And the same is true of Ukraine. You know, in terms of Ukrainian speakers, they've got a similar proportion in because they're all from the West Ukraine, the Ukrainian speakers.
So this Stefan Kapilov guy... Apparently, he's a neo-Nazi, and he's actually really...
Yes, he's a Russian right-wing neo-Nazi, yeah.
But is he working for the Russians?
Well, he might
This is
be.
What the SBU said.
Well, I know. I mean, the thing is, maybe the head of the SBU is working for the FSB. Maybe the head of MI6, the current head of MI6, is actually a Russian agent. I don't know. Do you?
Well, it might be an American agent. It might be an Israeli agent.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Is that also really possible? It is.
Well, of course, I mean,
if
this
you
is
blackmail
the,
or then, threaten somebody.
When you start talking about what spy agencies get up to, then of course they're desperately trying to infiltrate each other's structures all the time.
Actually, the police do this, don't they? The police in this country do this. What they have is some violent neo-Nazi, MI5, do this. But actually, he's working for them, supposedly.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is what this kind of intelligence world is like. And of course, it's very hard to work out what the hell's going on. mean, John le Carré wrote lots of famous books about how difficult it is to know whose side what people are on. And, you know, that's the real, you know, it's messy.
Well, so at least the, and he's apparently, this Stefan Kapilov was actually going to assassinate a politician in Ukraine who's anti-Russian as well. So, but although he's, I think, a Russian, I'm not sure, what they say was an anti-Russian dissident politician in Ukraine that is also potentially going to be assassinated by this Stefan Kapilov guy. So there's a political angle to it.
Well, yes, I mean, there's, what's happening is the Ukrainian state is being dismantled. Yeah, it's falling apart. And, of course, everybody's looking... I mean, there's been loads and loads of questions about the people around Zelensky and whether they've got their fingers in the till. And the fact is, virtually everybody's got their fingers in the till. Ukraine, even before this crisis, was a notoriously corrupt place. The oligarchy in the Ukraine ran everything. You know, the oligarchs like Poroshenko and so on, they took over the whole country after 1991. And it, you know, it's a mafia state in every realistic sense.
What about the MPs and the parliament in Kiev? Is it still functioning? Because I noticed
it's still functioning. Yeah. Of course, they were elected years ago.
There's been all sorts of stuff going on this week. It's been very bizarre. Like at the weekend, there was this massive explosion where the Russians hit a enormous arms dump in the middle of a residential area.
Yes.
Now that sounds to me like human people being used as human shields.
Well, that's what.
What is an arms dump doing in a residential area?
Up to now, the Russians have taken the view. We could hit an arms dump, probably, but there's all these civilians nearby, and we probably won't do it because they're there. But because of the attacks, I mean, Zelensky's threatening to close down St. Petersburg and Moscow airport. Yeah, they're going to attack airplanes, like at Leipzig, except real, yeah? And, of course, the Russians aren't happy with that. And, of course, all the stuff that's been happening, the Russians are now, they've got their election coming up, and the government's got to demonstrate to the electorate that it's in charge of the situation. And, you know, things which were off the table before, like, you know, destroying the electricity grid in Ukraine, they're doing it now. The Russians have basically said, well, we don't want to do this. If you keep pushing us, we will. And we've reached the point where they are. And in actual fact, of course, the Ukrainians are going to be the big losers there, because their capability to actually damage Russia is much smaller than the Russian capability to damage Ukraine. But, of course, ordinary people are the victims in all of this. They're the ones who are doing the dying.
So one of the people, I mean, it's actually really difficult to get a hold of English language footage of the Russian leadership, but here is just a fair, well, it's less than a minute, but this is a translated interview this week with the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov.
2 months ago, we officially warned all our foreign colleagues and the embassies, company, business offices, etc. And we warned, we recommended evacuate from Kiev. It does not mean that tomorrow something will happen, something that is expected by many. It is just a recommendation because of the strategy. A long-term strategy that will be implemented in order to achieve the goals of the special military operation.
Well, as you know, Lavrov, you know, speaks very cautiously, and he's, you know, they're basically, you know, they're warning the West, you know, you're pushing us too far.
Well, he's very, very clear, and what he's saying is that if you keep grabbing hold of Russian ships, we will start grabbing hold of British ships.
That's right. I mean, it's source for the goose, it's source for the gander.
And what they're doing, of course, is they're taking those cargoes and selling them. So it really is a form of piracy. So if you want to be pirates with us, which, of course, is a great tradition of British piracy over the centuries, we will just do the same to you, simple as that.
Well, that's right, because that's the only answer to that, isn't it?
Must be becoming more difficult to ensure shipping these days.
Well, that's right. I mean, the thing that's really closing the Strait of Hormuz is that Lloyd's of London won't give you the money to send a ship through, and you don't have to do much to make that happen. It's the recklessness of the West's policy towards Russia is unbelievable, but we are where we are.
So there are other things that have been going on this year. We've had this shootout, we've had this bombing of the massive arms dump in the middle of a residential area in Ukraine. But then there was also something else slightly curious, which is a massive drone factory getting destroyed or having a fire in Poland.
Yeah.
Which starts to look as if the Russians, this is asymmetric warfare. They're saying, well, sorry, guys, that's a shame your drone factory caught fire. But that could be, you see, if there's evidence to link that to Russia, that could be an attack which could trigger, is it article whatever it is of the NATO chart?
Yeah. Well, we're on the, you know, I mean, when we were hearing from von der Leyen earlier and so on, they're getting ready to say, well, we're at war now.
What seems so bizarre
once you cross over that line, you are at war, and the Russians will say, right,
they're saying some silly thing with a drone, which is not provable at all. This is what's really causing it. But they're ignoring an attack on a drone factory in Poland, which could definitely
Donald Tusk
be the Russians
Donald
doing
Donald Tusk, who's the Prime Minister in Poland, I think. I think he's the Prime Minister, not the President. He basically said, well, he thinks it is the Russians. And it wouldn't be surprising if it was. But, of course, the Russians are not going to say if they did it. If they did do it, they'll say, well, we're not saying anything.
You've talked about this guy Martyanov, isn't
Martyanov.
It? Martyanov. Tell us a bit about him, because we're going to hear a clip from him now.
Well, I mean, I've followed his blog for some years now. He's a former Russian naval officer. But he actually lives in the United States. He lives in the northwest United States. So I think he's got American citizenship, but he was originally a Russian naval officer. And so he's quite good on all the technical aspects of the fighting. That's what I read him for, really.
Okay, well, this isn't him reading. This is him doing on his YouTube channel, which is it's quite difficult to find. I think, isn't it called Reminiscences of...
Reminiscence of the Future is his... This is what the blog's called.
Right, well, anyway, he does every couple of days, he will do a little commentary, and here is his most recent one published, I think, either... Yeah, it's probably just yesterday.
It was the fight between the scumbags from SBU and GUR, which are essentially terrorist organizations nowadays, and they were trying to get one of them. I don't remember which one. SBU, GUR, I don't really... I'm not specialist in the times of the excrement. And so they were taking one of these guys, he's Russian, by the way, who is in charge of the RDK, which is a Russian volunteer corps. It's a neo-Nazi organization which fights against Russia, and which also, together with all those so-called intelligence people, I'm pretty sure the CIA which and MI6, which curate them, they're also involved in this, because, yeah, hey, payouts are good. They are running the call centers, which essentially do extortion and of the money from, primarily pensioners in Russia, and all over the world, by the way. It's a $1 billion, actually, organization, which, can you imagine, that good money. So they are not independent in many respects. They are actually a part of this so-called lack of intelligence network, which is, well, controlled by all kinds of the intelligence organization from the West, from NATO. So in this case, that's a really funny thing, but it tells you actually the full decomposition of what is going on there in terms of the political regime. And so... when you look at that, and especially when you look attentively at the development of the Russian offensives on several operational axes, and we'll talk about it, you begin to ask yourself a question, what the hell is going on? Well, what can I say? We'll start with that. And Vladimir Putin, Zelensky threatened every airline in Russian airspace. President Vladimir Putin has called the Ukrainian leader's statement a declaration of state terrorism. Zelensky stated that essentially that no aircraft, civilian aircraft, is safe in Russian airspace, including the international flights, which Russia still gets a lot of international flights, ranging from China to Vietnam to Turkey. Turkey is flying very actively, so all kinds of the Emirates actually fly there too. And so what is the Ukrainian military has been ramping ramping up long-range drone and missile attacks. That's also another statement which needs to be put in perspective. Against civilian infrastructure targets deep inside Russia, the strikes have repeatedly disrupted the work of civilian airports. Yes, they did. And very often, just because of the safety measures, Russia stops flying of the aircraft in and out of airports for some period of time before the those strikes are repelled and drones are shut down. But so what Vladimir Putin stated, that responding to what is the statement of this criminal Zelensky, safe days in Russia skies are over, Zelensky claimed, to the airlines currently flying to airports primarily in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and other key destinations. And so Vladimir Putin stated that it is obviously declaration of state terrorism, and then he added this famous phrase, which actually has been basically demonstrated time after time after time in all kinds of the operations and wars, and this, we do not negotiate with terrorists.
So there you go, there's Martyanov from the US, but he does do a pretty good commentary. He's talking there particularly about the this gunfight earlier this week between these two Ukrainian intelligence agencies, a security service and the intelligence service. And he's also saying that actually this organization, this neo-Nazi group, which is anti-Russian, with Stefan Kapulov, is also running call centers as a way of making money.
Yeah. That's what I've heard. These so-called intelligence organizations are in fact criminal structures, and they raise money. Yeah, just like the CIA deals drugs in Latin America. Everybody knows it.
Yeah. So the call centers are targeting people to get money from.
Yeah. It's a mafia state.
And also this idea of well, we're now going to start shooting down any old civilian airliner we feel like in Russia.
Yes, I mean, what they're doing is the attitude seems to be, both in the Ukrainian secret services and the MI6 and CIA, that if they do all sorts of things to make life miserable for ordinary Russians, that they're going to rise up and get rid of Putin because they'll just be fed up with all the nasty things that are happening. It's not working at all. The elections are going to be interesting, isn't it? Well, it's not going to be, it's going to be straightforward. United Russia will win. The question is whether they'll have more than 50% of the seats in the Duma. The communists will come second, but they'll be a long way behind. And the LDPR, who are the right wing, will come third, probably. But all of these major political forces in Russia are all united in the fact that they are not going to compromise with Ukraine over Ukraine and the West. That's the general settled opinion in Russia.
It's like the same with our political parties in this country. They're all united on that we are not going to end the war with Russia.
That's right, but the thing is that the Russians are going to win and we're going to lose. That's the difference.
They don't seem to care that they're going to lose, do they?
Well, they haven't thought about it.
Well, some people do, like Steve Jeremy we'll be hearing from in a minute. But what about Annie Burnham? Because Russia came up at Prime Minister's questions this team. Well, let's see how he gets on.
Thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, the British people should be under no illusion that the nation faces a significantly increased threat level, especially from Russia. But also, we have a US leadership for whom European security is no longer a focus or priority. And that is why it is imperative that we invest in our armed forces in the here and now, rather than be sorry later. Indeed, defence is definitely one area where vibes alone just isn't going to be enough. So rather than kick the can down the road, waiting for a fiscal event in the future, in a future year, will the Prime Minister urgently commit to charting a pathway to reach 3% of GDP spend on defence by 2030, which, as his Chancellor rightly noted, is critical to keep our country safe?
Well, I've made that commitment, made it very clear, Mr. Speaker, and I have done for a considerable period of time. And I was in Ukraine last week for a very specific reason, to repeat it on the world stage there. So the honourable gentleman can be absolutely sure of that. But I also think, alongside our commitment to defence, we also have to build the resilience of Britain. We need to ensure that the maximum amount of that funding committed to the Defence Investment Plan goes back into the reindustrialisation of our communities, that we do more to maintain sovereign manufacturing and production capability here. And this will be a theme of my government, making sure that the British taxpayers' money goes in to supporting industry in our own country to make us more resilient going into the future.
Well, I mean, the level of delusion here is extraordinary. I mean, they're away with the fairies, in my view. I mean, let's say for imagine that we do spend 3% of our GDP on defence. Don't forget that our GDP might start going down if we have a crash. So 3% of less will be less money. Yeah, it may be that the money we're spending now will be 3% of our GDP after a crash. But in any case, what are they going to spend it on? Most of this money is going to have to be spent on American kit because we don't produce our own kit, and if we can probably produce drones. But then the drones aren't the thing. What we really need is hypersonic missiles. But the Iranians and the Russians have been developing them for the last 30 years. Even if we wanted to have hypersonic missiles, it would take at least 10, 15 years to get them. And by that time, as the Russians will wait until we're nearly there, and then they will hit the factories where we're making them. Everybody just presumes that the Russians can't hear what we're saying. You know, they listen to everything we say. The Chinese listen to it. We're going to have a war with China. And the Chinese are going, yeah, you keep saying that, don't you?
Yeah.
How does that come across?
The Americans do wear their heart on their sleeve, don't they? They don't really... Yeah. Although I think there's quite a lot of top-level links between China and the Americans that we don't really get to hear about. Well, unless you start thinking about things like Tony Fauci funding the development of biological weapons over in Wuhan, then you can realise there is something going on.
Yes, but that was coming back to the lockdown issue, but COVID looks as if it was deliberately created. This is what Jeffrey Sachs is saying.
I just want to use that as a point to illustrate that there are top level corporations between people that say that they're enemy.
But that top level
corporation is making biological weapons. Well, great.
Yes, and the biological weapons. The Chinese wouldn't have deliberately released biological weapons in their own jurisdiction, would they?
Well, they shouldn't have done the dirty deal with Fauci. No, they shouldn't. Then, should they?
That's
a bunch of silly swamp.
Yes. Head's probably wrong.
Anyway, look. Well, you mentioned this guy Steve Jeremy last week, and you're right. He's an absolutely fascinating bloke, Martin. And here he is on GB News this week. In fact, I think it was actually last Friday, pointing out that John Healey, the new Defence Secretary, he resigned because he said they weren't spending this 3% on defence. And yet he announced last week that he won't be spending 3% on defence. So in a way, he's shelving his own defence target.
Now the Chancellor, John Healey, will shelve his own target of spending 3% GDP on defence by 2030 when he delivers his first budget in October. Now, if you recall, Mr Healey resigned as Defence Secretary in June, saying Sir Keir Starmer's government wasn't prepared to spend enough money on Britain's armed forces. Confused? Join the club. I'm joined now by the former Royal Navy officer, Commodore Steve Jeremy. Steve, a pleasure to have your company. Am I missing something here, Steve? Because Mr. Healey resigned over the fact that the government wasn't spending 3% on defence, and now he's the Chancellor. He's in charge of the DOSH. He's going to tell us that there isn't 3% for defence.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, Martin, that having jumped from one place to the other, then actually the reality of Britain's fiscal situation is now becoming clear. Martin, there's a short-term issue and a long-term issue here. The long-term issue is how much we do spend on defence. It depends on what we really want defence for. And in my mind, we're focused far too much on offence abroad and much less well focused on defence at home, which essentially means having a Navy and Air Force that are able to protect our skies and to protect our seas and protect our overseas responsibilities. But the short-term issue is more acute, Martin, because actually a lot of people are connecting this to the situation with Russia. And we know that the Russians are escalating, and the Russians have actually withdrawn their ambassador, and they've warned us that they are likely or are minded to actually respond against Britain and outside the Ukraine area. So outside the Ukraine campaign area. Mm. double defence spending tomorrow, we still not will be in a position to actually defend ourselves against the weapons that we could be threatened with. The Russians are leading the world in terms of hypersonic missiles and conventional ballistic missiles, and with both of these, we have no effective defence in Britain. So were the Russians to decide to use one or more of those missiles as a means of demonstrating that they mean what we were saying, we could not defend ourselves and would not really be able to respond in kind. So I think that's the issue. We've got to be careful to separate the issue of how much defence spending that we are doing and what should be our policy in the short term. At the moment, we're doing the opposite of what Theodore Roosevelt said, which is speak softly and carry a large stick. We're speaking loudly and carrying a small stick, and it worries me.
Well, that's pretty accurate summary. We are not in a position to fight with Russia. You know, the Crimean War is a long time ago, and we're not in a we're a mid-level minor power. Why would we want to try and fight with Russia?
Low level.
Well, low level, yes. I mean, of course, as he points out, the hypersonic missiles thing is absolutely crucial. If we wanted to have a war with Russia, we should have developed those hypersonic missiles 20 years ago. And now saying we're going to spend some more money.
So they haven't learned
pointless.
Any lessons from Theodore Roosevelt, have they? This idea of speaking quietly but carrying a large stick. He's saying there that they're speaking loudly and carrying a small stick.
That's right. And, of course, there's an unreality here. There's an awful lot of rhetoric about we've got to stand with Ukraine, even though the Ukrainians are killing Russian civilians with our help. Of course, in Russia itself, we've got the election coming up, they have a different media environment from us, and they're being bombarded every day with pictures of civilians in Russia and Belarus being killed by drones possibly made up the road here in Filton.
I mean, Steve Jeremy, I really like this guy. He's actually pointing out something really crucial here that nobody else is talking about, which is that Britain's foreign policy doesn't actually line up with its defence strategy.
The critical issue in terms of defence is really making sure that we have our foreign policy and our defence strategy aligned. I don't know what our defence strategy is. It seems to be speak loudly.
It does.
Seems to be double down on Ukraine, although it looks to me like Ukraine is losing and losing badly. It seems to me that we're planning to support attacks deep into Russia. The problem there, of course, is that with our current policy, we're actually increasing energy costs at a time when people are complaining. So at the moment, we have sanctions on Russia, which is removing hydrocarbons, that's oil and gas, from the world markets. The situation in the Strait of Hormuz is difficult, and that too is rising up the price of oil and gas. And last but by no means least, if you're sending weapons into Russia to attack Russian oil and gas facilities, then surprise, surprise, that takes oil and gas out of the markets, and surprise, surprise, the cost of our oil and gas goes up. So if people are worried about their energy prices, which in turn is explaining their cost of living crisis, then look no further than the policy of Britain, of Europe, and of the United States. This is something which we really need to be
Steve, I really think the British public are getting tired of endless billions of pounds being available to Ukraine. Now, I know it's important, but we can't defend our own borders. Look, many people think that our own country is being invaded day by day by day. Do you accept that that's a huge problem? Security begins on our own shore. Never mind some front far, far away, Steve.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Martin. I wrote an article for the Times just after I'd left the Navy in which I said that in defence, then the critical things are to be able to protect your seas and skies and protect your imports of energy, food and commodities. And those are the fundamental issues, Martin. And that actually everything you do after that is discretionary. But you're right, the money that's being spent in Ukraine is money that's wasted. The Americans, or so the Ukrainians, have burned through the 80 or so billion euros that were loaned to them and that we will never see back, and are now asking for more money. So we should not be at all surprised, actually, if they do come back for more money. We're asked to spend more money, which, as far as I'm concerned, is good money after bad. In terms of sunk costs, all we're doing is actually increasing the risk to an attack on Britain, and it worries me, Steph.
You know, I think we really got somewhere there. I really, really do. And I sincerely appreciate your take today. I do. You're an expert. Thank you for sharing your brain with us, Royal Naval Officer Commodore Steve Jeremy. Pleasure. Thank you. A government spokesperson told GB News this. The first duty of government is to keep its citizens safe. The Prime Minister and Chancellor are committed to fully funding the defence investment plan. At the spending review, we will set out a pathway to meet our NATO commitment of 3.5% of GDP on defence by 2035 and will set a target to hit 3% on that path.
So the first duty, there's a statement at the end by the government there, the first duty of the government is to keep its people safe. And Steve Jeremy's spelling out that they're not doing that at all.
No, because the United States wants world domination and we are a poodle in that game. That's what we're doing, what the Americans and the Israelis want. The Israelis tell the Americans what to do, the Americans tell us what to do. What's our national interest? We need to be a neutral country.
He's
like
saying
Austria.
That should be the role of the armed forces, to protect our sea and sky and people. And the government is saying, well, that's our first priority. But of course, they're not doing it.
Because we are airstrip one for the Americans, who started all these wars in the Middle East. And of course, that's much closer to us than it is to them. And the destruction of Libya by the Royal Air Force has led directly to all of the problems that we're facing with refugees and so forth.
And so he's a former naval officer, senior naval officer, and he's saying, actually, we're backing a loser with Ukraine. He's talking also about things like sunk costs and throwing good money after bad. This is a very simple way of describing it.
This is common sense stuff from
Why
him.
Are no MPs saying this?
Because MPs, he's a retired naval officer, so he's allowed to have an opinion. Serving naval officers are not allowed to say that sort of thing, even if they think it. And, of course, he's not necessarily in a majority within the armed forces.
No, I would imagine not. But anyway, I mean, the point is, at least he's a voice, the people who are talking.
Well, it's good to hear some common sense, you know. I mean, underlying all of this is that America has become a rogue state. 9/11's anniversary coming up next Friday. That was the deep state in the United States. The Russians know it, the Chinese know it, the Iranians know it. It's only ordinary people who don't know it. And that's why world wars come from.
So just staying with Steve Jeremy, he did also, I found an absolutely fascinating longer interview, which this is just an excerpt from, with the US military colonel, retired colonel Douglas McGregor. In fact, there's another interview which I might put up on as a longer interview, all about former Yugoslavia, because Douglas McGregor was a colonel in the US Army in the Yugoslav conflict, and he raises some fascinating points about the strategy there, saying that there was all these discussions about how they really wanted to hammer the Serbs and then we're going to bomb Serbia. We don't want to talk to them. We just bomb them. And this is during the 1990s. But also how all of the various generals, including him, and colonels and senior officers, were saying to the Pentagon, well, hang on a minute, you know, this is right in the middle of Russia's backyard. And it was really probably, Martin, only because the 1990s were a complete chaos in Russia, that Russia wasn't able to really interfere or do anything to stop the breakup of Yugoslavia and the interference of NATO there.
Well, they got fed up. Because when Kosovo didn't have any referendum or whatever, the Kosovo Liberation Army were demanding that Kosovo should be separated from Serbia, even though historically it had always been part of Serbia. But when the people in the Donbass decide that they don't want to be part of the Ukraine anymore, that's terrible. But of course, the Russians just see this as special pleading. You go around breaking countries up. Yeah, you broke off a chunk of southern Sudan. You've dispossessed the Palestinians. The Kosovans were allowed to have a rebellion against the Serbs, and we've supported them. But when Russian peace-speaking people do similar things, it's all terrible, and we've got to go to war with them. And of course, you know, the rest of the world, you know, South Africa, for example. They look at this and they can see the hypocrisy of it all.
Let's have a listen now to a bit more from Steve Jeremy, quite a lot more, but also his chit-chat here on the issues that we've been talking about with Colonel Douglas McGregor.
Two critical things I used to say were industrial capacity and energy. And you needed both to actually run a war. And the famous quote I used was from Yamamoto, who was the admiral who, you know, oversaw the early days of the war. And he said, anybody who's been to the oil fields of Texas or the automobile factories of Ohio knows that we can never win a long-term war with the United States. And he was right, of course. But I think we've lost sight of that. The thing I add now to, there's a third element, which we're also lacking in, which is the ability to think strategically and clearly. And we've just lost that completely. But I think the two other things that I've come to realize are also playing into this. The first is that I think, certainly for the United States, but also to a lesser extent for Britain, we have sort of armies which are, we have armed forces which are configured more for air, sea, rather than land. And of course, the primary, opponents at the moment that we've mistakenly chosen are configured the other way around, but they're also configured in a way where they can deny us air superiority and they can deny us sea control. And that's a very, very fundamental change. There's another thing that I think is also very interesting, which is to pick up on your point, Doug, that people say, no, we need to spend more money. And I keep saying, well, surely we should work out why we want to spend the money. And the second thing is we should work out if the money's being well spent. Now, if you listen to Professor Michael Hudson, he'll distinguish between, on the one hand, industrial capitalism, which he says is what happens in Russia and China. On the other hand, sort of services capitalism, financial capitalism, I'm sorry, is the word he used, which is what happens in the West. You know, so we've got most of our GDP is made up of services, which is fine, unless you want to fight a war. And so I think we get particularly poor value for money in the West and the way we spend money on defense. I'm not 100% sure why, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. Because I look at the force structure that we've got at the moment. I just take my own service, the Royal Navy. Yeah, we're spending probably a little bit less than we were, but we've got 12 hulls, I suppose, at frigates and destroyers versus 70 when I was serving. You know, and that matters because, you know, the numbers do actually matter if you want to use forces at sea. There are a whole range of reasons for that, but they matter. So I think that the idea that we can just spend more money and that will solve the problem, let me forget it. Forget it. Think about really how we spend the money and what we're going to spend the money for and also where we invest. I mean, I'll just about to stop, but of course, one of the issues is NATO. And I'm just doing an article which is about how we should be retiring NATO because we don't get good value for money. The best we make in NATO, and it doesn't work.
Well, you know, one of my favorite people is former Prime Minister Campbell Bannerman. Campbell Bannerman gets very little attention because he offended the British public when he apologized for what the British Army and its forces had done to the Boer population. You'll recall the concentration camp, 78,000 or so dead as a result, women and children and else. I always thought he was a very great man. Mm. That. But he also had a very good head on his shoulders. And when he was meeting with the French, and of course, you remember Henry Wilson, I guess was his name, was pushing this Franco-German business in World War I.
Yeah.
Bannerman didn't have much use for him. And he was in a discussion with the president of France. And the president of France said, well, we, you know, this is very important to us because when we go to war, we want the British Army with us. And he said, what? He said, on the continent? He said, yes. And he said, well, that's outrageous. He said, why would we ever put a British Army on the continent? That would be a serious strategic mistake. It would ruin us. And that's not our interest. Our interests are elsewhere, not on the continent. And, of course, he was right. Mm. Unfortunately, he dies. And he's succeeded by that jackass Asquith. Mm. He knew absolutely nothing about much of anything, as far as I can tell, with the foreign minister, Gray, who was equally ignorant. The next time you get somebody who has got his head on, in my judgment, is Macmillan. Mm. And Kennedy is talking to Macmillan and mentions Vietnam in the future. Macmillan says, forget it. It's not going to happen. Made that very clear to LBJ. Unfortunately, you know, Macmillan doesn't last. He goes away. Made a lot of sense. And the problem that we have right now is that whatever we're doing is completely divorced from tangible, concrete, strategic interest. Mm. We are in the hands or the grip of a small minority of very wealthy people. We call it AIPAC, Zionists. It's this Jewish financial elite that's played a major role in financializing the economy because that's how they make money. Mm. These are not production capitalists. This is not J.D. Rockefeller. Vanderbilt, Carnegie, you know, building steel mills, you know, turning out railroads and so forth. These are financial experts who've turned everything into a casino, and then they control the betting. And you've seen that with the manipulation of the cost of oil by the White House. You know, every time Trump makes a statement, suddenly all sorts of people short oil or make investments. And then you find out, well, gee, I guess they had the word for the White House. You think? So we've got a real problem with corruption and financialization. That's not going to go away. And the impossibility of really establishing what's in our interest. And, you know, why would the British want an army of 250,000? There's no reason for that. Mm. I don't know what the number is, but, you know, where do you plan to fight? What are you planning to do? And that question needs to be answered honestly. If we had been honest with ourselves, we'd say, wait a minute, you want us to put an expeditionary force to run into Yemen and capture the Houthis? Well, we can look at that. You know, we have the naval power. We have over 100,000 Marines looking for something to do. So potentially we could do that. But if you want us to go to the Persian Gulf and challenge Iran, have you looked at the geography? That's absurd. Mm. It makes no sense. Mm. Are you crazy? But that wasn't done. Nobody brought it up.
Yeah.
And that's why the other problem, and I'm sure you could talk about this, where have we gotten these people?
Mm.
I remember Montgomery during the Second World War, 1942, grew sick of the Canadians who wanted to land desperately in Normandy. They were as bad as we were. We wanted to go to Normandy in 1942. And of course, everybody with any sense who knew anything about the German military said, that's absurd, you'll get killed. But finally, you had Mountbatten, who had created this sort of flotilla of ships, and he was going to support the intervention at Dieppe.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Montgomery finally said, do it. Go ahead. And he reasoned later on, it was better to go ahead and do that, lose people that way, than bet everything on a large invasion, which was premature and unprepared. And he was right. Mm. But we have a lot of Dieppe thinkers.
Mm.
I call them thinkers at all. We don't have anybody who's asking the hard questions and answering them, and nobody will stand up to anybody. And now to listen, as I have to these Democrats on the Hill, these senators.
Well, you know, Mr. Hegseth, you, this is your failure. You failed. That's why we're failing in the Gulf. Our soldiers can do anything.
You know, the last man that said our soldiers can do anything was Adolf Hitler. Okay. Mm. He had a much better case, and he was wrong. And everybody knew he was wrong. We can't do everything, nor should we try, nor should we need to. But no one will stand up and do it. So you have all these four stars. Well, Mr. President, this could be tough, but I'm with you. And, you know, when Hegseth shows up as Secretary of Defense, nobody walks up and says, well, Mr. Hegseth, you really need to look through this briefing that we've prepared and all these materials, because you will find what the true stocks are for all the critical munitions, missiles. You will look at all the constraints as well as the advantages our force structure has, and some of the requirements we may want to look into for the future if we are going to conduct active military operations. Mm. Nobody does that.
Mm.
And he shows up, and they give him a funny little hat, Jeremy. Do you do that? Royal Navy, you give the new minister a funny little hat, and it's the boss with little stars on it. And he stands there, oh, this is great. I'm in charge of the Navy now. They sort of stick a lollipop in his mouth. You know, give him a sedative, send him to bed. You know, it's ridiculous. Don't get me started. Yeah. So I think it's a mess.
I think you're on to the other thing. This, I mean, when I said that one of the problems we have is the inability to think strategically, the people who do the strategic thinking are the establishment, the right people right at the top of the establishment. They're the generals, the admirals, the air marshals, the senior civil servants. It's not just the politicians. And I feel a little bit for the politicians, because they ultimately come in often from a business background or something else, and they sort of rely on the possibility or the hope that actually the people who talk to them know what they're talking about. But as I say, the thing is, when you're thinking about strategy, you know you've been successful. If the results of your strategy were effective, they were efficient, and they were enduring. And if you can pass those three tests, then you've got a solid way of measuring strategy. And it's a pretty hard-nosed way of measuring strategy. But on those measures, we've lost everything we've done this century. Everything. There's not a single thing that I think that we've done. And I don't think that's just the fault of the politician. I mean, Ian, you as a diplomat will know as well, because it's not just about the military, but it's about the diplomats as well. And somewhere the advice that's being provided to people is not right. I mean, it's obvious in the results, but nothing seems to be being done about it.
Fascinating, I think, chit-chat between those two military people there. And he's saying, Martin, actually, the real fault may lie not just with the politicians, but also with the very senior military, people above their heads, who are coming out with absolute nonsense, and the politicians just tick and sign off on these ridiculous wars that we always lose.
Yeah, well, the deep state is a thing. Yeah, the politicians are basically, they're like kids at a party. You know, they get the sweets and they get a present and then they go home. But the state itself is, war is the health of the state. And of course, a lot of the military advice that's being given is being given by generals who actually, what they're really angling for is a job on the board of Northrop Grumman or whatever it is once they've retired. That doesn't happen in Russia because they've got a nationalized military. You know, military production, and it's all done, for on a not-for-profit, we're fighting to win basis.
Okay, well, look, finally on Russia, let's have a listen. We had an interview with Vladimir Goldstein last week, and he had, I think, some fascinating insight. He's a professor of Slavic studies at Brown University on the East Coast, US, in New York State, I think it is. And it's a pretty good university. And he has this to say about the Nazis in Ukraine. We had a little bit from RT people and the BBC didn't talk about the Nazi angle on this shootout in Kiev this week. So let's have a listen to Vladimir Goldstein's take on, from a Russian Slavic studies professor in the States point of view, what about the problem with the neo-Nazis? Are the Russians right to be pointing out that this is a real thing in Ukraine?
Russians are, they are not very happy with what Ukrainians are doing by resurrecting. The problem is, of course, every country has their own kind of grim past, be it Germany, Austria, Russia itself, with Stalin, but basically most of the countries, or Spain and Franco, but they don't, build monuments to these past tyrants, to past murderers. There is some Russian bus driver can have a picture of Stalin in his, window, but that's about it. While Ukrainians, all of a sudden, they well-established criminals, people who butchered endless amount of Poles and Jews and Russians, all of a sudden they are pronounced heroes. Can you imagine, Austrians are just starting celebrating Hitler and so on. So Russians, found it very unappealing, and it was part of their kind of discourse where they basically said that's why we have to fight. But obviously there are other reasons, like NATO sort of approaching and so on. But I think what is interesting, what you said about lack of information about Russia, that's a paradox of recent times. If you remember this German term, Putin Versteher. In other words, they mock people who try to understand Russia. And this is kind of very silly. We have to understand what every culture is coming from if we want to deal with it. Because otherwise you can walk into totally unexpected territory. Everybody in the United States and the establishment, they kind of knew anxiety and nervousness in Iran, that people, not all Iranians were happy and behind their government. So they thought it's going to be a walk in the park. We'll kill the leader and we'll take over. Well, turns out it didn't happen. Why? Because they obviously didn't really know, or didn't want to know, or ignored people who know, and mocked people who know, who was telling them Iran is not that simple. You cannot just, overturn it. It is a culture also, with its traditions, with this kind of respect for authority, with this anger at the interfering foreigners could keep on, installing governments. So I think you have to know, and you have to understand
But I think it was a very deliberate solution recently with the collapse of the Soviet Union that this country is not that powerful, so we don't even want to understand them. And that was very disturbing.
It was. And I mean, you could make an analogy with people like Joseph Goebbels and Adolf Hitler, who didn't really want to understand Jewish culture at all in the 1930s. And look where that led us. Anyway, Vladimir Goldstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony, and all the best to your listeners.
So I'll put the full version of that up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. It's great to have his insight, Martin, and what he's saying there about the... I mean, he's saying he's comparing what's going on in Ukraine now to Austria having statues of Adolf Hitler all over the place.
Well, that's right. And, of course, there's big tensions with Poland. And I know what goes on in Poland because I used to live there. Because the Ukrainian nationalists, the Banderites, killed tens of thousands of Polish civilians in the Second World War. And, of course, the Warsaw Uprising was eventually crushed by the Ukrainian Galicia SS. So they were all Ukrainians that finished off the Polish Home Army, the Army of Krajowa, after the 1944 uprising.
Do you think it's so long ago people don't remember that?
They do remember it in Poland. And, of course, the right wing remember it as well. And this is one of the problems the right wing has all over the world, that right wing Poles hate right wing Ukrainians and vice versa.
I think people forget things, a bit like the British forget that the Zionist terrorists were killing loads of Brits, in fact, were trying to kill Winston Churchill back in the 1940s.
That's right. Well, I mean, most people don't even know what happened yesterday, never mind what happened 50 years ago. But, of course, it's all of these things carry on mattering, you know. It seems that history is to blame, but most people don't know any of it.
So Iran is saying that it attacked US bases in Kuwait and the UAE. So this is looking now at the resumption of the attacks on Iran by the United States. J.D. Vance says he's sceptical that the US actually bombed a wedding, despite actually there being plenty of film evidence that the wedding was indeed bombed and people were killed at the wedding in Iran.
Yes, and of course the same with the attack on the Minab school. The question is, was it an accident or was it deliberate? I think in the case of the Starobelsk massacre of the teenage girls in Donetsk, that looks deliberate because it was a three-tap strike. Yeah, they hit it once, killed a load of people. When the first responders turned up, they hit it again. And when second responders turned up, they hit them again. And this is a school. Yeah, they knew what they were doing. And, of course, the Israelis have gone out of their way to kill civilians.
Yeah, this is deliberate psychological warfare. As well as physical kinetic war. Donald Trump has been saying today that anyone who's reporting shortages of missiles, of American missiles, are committing treason.
Well, I mean, it's acts of desperation.
He's a bit in denial, isn't he?
Yes, denial is not just a river in Egypt, yeah.
Oh, God, that's dreadful. But it is. Look, I mean, there are missile shortages. As Steve Jeremy was saying, there's been no strategy. Hexeth has just signed off on this without actually having a plan at all. So, actually, it's very much like the Iraq war. It's the intelligence being fitted around the strategy. So a decision has been made, we're going to attack Iran, and they don't even care whether they can get away with it or not.
Well, it looks quite clear that people like Tulsi Gabbard, for example, who's now resigned, were saying to them, this is bonkers, the Iranians will not fold in 3 days. But, of course, Bibi Netanyahu, possibly because he's got blackmail compromat on Trump, said, no, we've got to do this. And, you know, against all advice, I mean, every war game they've played when they fight Iran, they lose. Including the guy from the 1990s who played the war game with them. I've forgotten his name now. He's a US Marine colonel who paid the Iranians. They never win. Every time they've war game against Iran, they always lose.
You know always, what? There's always, something always. A little bit masochistic or suicidal about the US authorities.
The United States and Iran have carried out their biggest exchange of attacks since July. Iran says at least 12 people were killed in the latest US strikes, one of which it claimed hit a wedding in the south of the country. Iran's foreign ministry described that as a war crime. The Pentagon has insisted it does not target civilians. In response, Iran says it carried out attacks on American targets across the Middle East. Our correspondent, Katie Watson, sent this report from Jerusalem.
There were intense bombardments overnight. The month-long lull in the war apparently over. On the ground in Iran, there was panic and confusion after a missile hit a house where a wedding was taking place. Those killed included children. Iranian state media said a civilian airport and a factory were also attacked, resulting in more casualties. The latest strikes also provoked a war of words, with Iran's top negotiator, Mohammad Ghalibaf, accusing the United States of being Satan. The US denied targeting civilians. Iran retaliated with missile and drone attacks in Jordan and across the Gulf. Just last week, Washington seemed to be pivoting away from military action and towards economic pain, imposing yet more sanctions on Iran in an effort to find a path forward and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. But that was short-lived. It's back to strikes, counter-strikes, and a growing fear that this could keep escalating.
So they're off again. The Americans have decided they're going to send the B-1s over and all the rest from Fairford, and they're going to carry on this war.
Well, that was always going to be the case. They're not going to back down because they can't, which means they're going to have to be totally defeated. But that will mean the end of the American empire, and maybe we could be independent from them.
Just looking at this from a sort of more strategic, distant point of view, this lady, Ayn Rand, she's very interested in the Middle East, and she had this to say about Israel and the Middle East. Now, let's just to put this in context, she's a sort of 1950s, 1960s version of the Dark Enlightenment, my old schoolmate, Nick Land. In a way, what she's doing is she's saying, actually, money should rule the world, and might is right, and we don't really care about the law too much because it gets in the way of money, Martin.
That's right. She invented a philosophy which she called objectivism, which means that everybody should just look after themselves and be totally selfish. And if everybody's totally selfish, it'll all be all right. Funny that Aristotle, Socrates, Jesus, Confucius, they never said anything like that. But she knows better.
Yes.
Yes, just so, be selfish.
So let's go back to the 1960s and have a listen to what she had to say about the Middle East.
Plug is against. I'd like to know your opinion on the United States' foreign policy and what is happening in the Middle East right now.
Right now, I'm not sure we know what's happening. I think that the United States' foreign policy has been disgraceful for years, for decades. I would say roughly since the New Deal, and in part even before that. But if you mean whose side should one be on, Israel or the Arabs, I would certainly say Israel because it's the advanced, technological, civilized country amidst a group of almost totally primitive savages who have not changed for years and who are racist and who resent Israel because it's bringing industry and intelligence and modern technology into their stagnation.
Your philosophy of objectivism.
That's right.
I just have one point that I think should be made, Ms. Rand, with time fleeting here. Your characterization of the situation in the Middle East came down rather gratuitously and in a very angry way on the Arabs, and without discussing the merits of either side in a most complicated and painful collision of cultures and peoples in our world. Why couldn't the millions of men, women, and children who are Arab and who find themselves in this desperate conflict and look around wondering where peace will be, why can't they be angry with you for your characterization of them, your slap at them, your roundhouse criticism of them, when you don't seem to be able to tolerate a questioner who suggests that she disagrees with you? Characterization is you do not accept any criticism unless you level it.
No, I don't resort to terrorism. I don't go around murdering my opponents, innocent women and children. That is what I have against the Arabs. That takes the conflict out of the sphere of civilized conflict and makes it murderous. And anyone, private citizens, who resort to force is a monster. And that's what makes me Ms. Rand. Condemn and despise them.
So that's Ayn Rand there in the 1960s talking about, I imagine, during roughly during the time of the, say, the Six-Day War. I'm not sure that was during the 1960s.
67.
Yeah. But what an interesting attitude. So they're basically primitives, the Arabs, and what the reason to support Israel is because they're an advanced civilization.
Well, and she says that the Arabs are racists. You think, gosh, pop kettle black, Ayn.
Yeah, and terrorism. And if citizens...
Oh no, the Irgun and the Haganah and the Lehi, they weren't terrorists, you see. They were freedom fighters. Yeah? It's the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. They're terrorists. Yeah? I'll tell you who's a terrorist. George Washington. He was a terrorist, wasn't he? He killed loads of British soldiers. He should have been put down, shouldn't he?
Finally then, anyway, we've got something called the Defence Authorisation Act. House passes the 2027 ND Authorisation Act, National Defence Authorisation Act, with section to integrate US and Israeli militaries. Now, this is a bit mad, isn't it? The bill has passed in a 216-212 vote, with 6 Democrats supporting the Republicans, 7 Republicans voting no. The House on Wednesday passed, this is last week, this is July, sorry, the massive $1.15 trillion National Defence Authorisation Act, which includes a Section 219, formerly Section 224, provision to further integrate US and Israeli military, a scheme Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has described as my plan.
Well, I mean, this is, you know, this is an attempted takeover of the US military by the Israelis.
In a formal way, in fact.
Yes, they've been controlling them for years, but this is, that, you know, any new government that comes to power in the US will have to face the fact that the Israelis are in total charge of the military. But, of course, the Israelis were very involved in 9/11. And, of course, this is where a lot of this stuff comes from. The deep state in the West is massively penetrated by the Israeli intelligence services, and they are calling the shots.
Well, they certainly seem to be. Anyway, we're going to finish up this week with an interview, which and it's I've got a sort of attachment to this because back in 2016. When my YouTube channel was algorithmed, I suppose you'd call it, from back in 2016, things used to be able to work their way up through the YouTube algorithms to pop up, you know, if they were being looked at a lot, or if they were the words in the description of the video and things being said in the video were similar to things other people were looking for, they used to be, amplified. And I was getting something like 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 regularly views of the videos I was putting up. Nowadays, it's kind of gone back since 2016, 2017. It's gone right down to sort of several hundred. So maybe a tenth of what it used to be. And there's somebody else that this happened to is a guy, I'm not quite sure of his name, Sean, I think his name, from the SGT report. And in that SGT report, one of his videos made 3 million hits. One of my videos have made, I think it was 1.8 million hits, because it's just what people were looking for, and they found it. Nowadays, they don't find it, because accounts like the SGT report and mine are now algorithmed out by YouTube. And so this is his... My one at the time was about what it was called, what the BBC won't tell you about Brexit, and it was just before the Brexit vote. But his is called Tornado in a Junkyard, and it's all about creation versus evolution. And here's an extract from it now, and I've just put this up on one of my pages, because I can see that it was initially gotten rid of completely by YouTube, completely cancelled the guy's channel, even though this video is really nothing controversial. It's just a discussion of creation versus evolution, and it had got 3 million hits.
The best place to start is at the beginning of life. Oh, we know. You know what, Sean? I want you to put a graphic up on the screen, because I think it's important we give our audience a 1 minute refresher on what the theory of evolution says.
Can do. What?
What the theory says is that life began in the ocean billions of years ago, when the right chemicals formed our single-celled ancestors by chance, and then these single-celled creatures began to evolve into multicellular creatures, and they became the first sea-going invertebrates, a creature without a backbone like a jellyfish. Then the invertebrates evolved into fish, and then fish yearned to come ashore, and so their fins started to evolve into legs, and they became the first amphibians, which are creatures, of course, that can go on land or water like a frog. And then amphibians evolved into reptiles, reptiles evolved into mammals, and then eventually within the class of mammals, you had these ape-like creatures who evolved into man. And that's the theory in a nutshell. It might be taught a little differently from one school of thought to another, but that's it. And that's basically what your kids are taught in school. So to start at the beginning, the origin of life, and Darwin did talk about that, the origin of species, said that life began in a warm little pond, but after a while they realized that a pond wouldn't last long enough for significant evolution to take place, so they changed it to the ocean. So let's see what's wrong with this. Now, I've got a can here of all-natural cola, and if we look at it, it says cola. It says 12 ounces, which it reminds us, in this case, is 354 mls.
I laughed because you said all-natural cola. I don't think there's anything natural about cola, but go ahead.
Well, it's from Whole Foods.
It's
as natural as cola can get. Let's put it that way.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Copy.
All right. Now, it says Whole Foods on it, and it's got a list of ingredients, the amount of fat and sodium, and it's got a barcode, which is scannable, and it's got a pop top, which works very nicely, and it's got cola inside, very tasty, right? Now, does anybody think that this can and its contents and the printing on the outside could have originated by pure chance? And obviously not. I mean, it's too well designed. So that raises the question of how could a cell come about by chance, because it's astronomically more complex than the can I just showed you. And I want to give you a quote. The quote is this, quote, "A simple one-celled bacterium, R. coli, contains DNA information units that are the equivalent of 100 million pages of Encyclopedia Britannica," unquote. And that quote is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, cells have a functional unit called proteins. That's their basic unit. And even in a bacterial cell, there's thousands of different proteins. And not to get technical, but proteins are found down in a smaller building block called amino acids, and there's hundreds in one protein, and they have to be in the right order. And some of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard of Francis Crick. He won the Nobel Prize for co-discovering the structure of DNA. And he calculated what the odds would be of getting a protein by chance, you know, in the ancient ocean. You know what the odds are, according to Francis Crick? The odds are 1 in 10 to the power of 260. And if you want to know how big a number that is, you couldn't fit that many electrons in the known universe. Mathematicians usually say that anything with odds greater than 1 in 10 to the power of 50 is impossible. So it would be impossible to get one protein by chance, let alone the thousands a cell would need. And think about it. A cell would need the ability to ingest nutrients, expel waste. And really think about this one. This first cell formed by chance before it died in the span of one lifetime would have had to develop and perfect the process of cellular reproduction, because if it didn't, there never would have been a second cell, and Darwin's evolutionary process would stop right there.
So there you go. he makes it sound so simple, doesn't he? So how come we've at least our kids are being taught the opposite of this, by the way? I wonder why that is. The ode this week is, so I'll put a link up to that on our show page this week, .org.uk, the full video. So the ode is "Data Rich, History Poor." "Mad men, sad men, think they can live forever. Well, that's their plan. Masonic clad men, women too, created Zionists, this much is true. A taste for genocide they savour. Skulls and bones in rubble favour. 27 million dead, yet not a whisper of this said. To generations, no truth e'er spoken. Just hate for Russia, their only token. No respect or gratitude, just horrid, nasty, ugly, rude. Triad men, clad men, traitors made, stabbing hearts with sharpened blades, madmen zeal with white nose twitch, battlefields now data rich, gold mined troves, defence AI, hostile actors, defence site lies. A warning sign to all who heed on our data watch them feed. Well, thanks, Patricia. And that is a story which has only come out the last couple of days, which is this, which I will put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which is that while Andy Burnham was over in Ukraine, in Kiev, they signed a nice little deal, which means that the, in order to give them some money, all of the data that's been collected from the front line of this war with Russia, from all the drones, all the video data, and everything to do with how that successful a kill has been, is all now being sold to the British, and Britain is getting hold of all this data so we can use it in order to protect our vital infrastructure, things like power stations, supposedly. And obviously they will also be using it in order to train the military and train AI. So I'll put a link up to that rather shocking, nasty little story about how the Brits, what the Brits are getting out of Ukraine is how to use AI and drones to kill people and stop them entering wherever they want to stop them entering. Well, how bizarre is that? Anyway, it's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off now. Thanks, first of all, to Linda Beamish, who's still sitting here with her dog patiently. Also, of course, to John Langley, we heard at the very beginning. Thanks to Steve Jeremy, even though he's not an official interviewee. He was an amazing and interesting guy. Let's just put him in charge, shall we? Maybe a military coup with Steve in charge. Sounds almost sensible, but of course, maybe not. And also to thanks very much to our sound engineer, Dave Bazanko. You can download this show as an MP3 from 11 p.m. or so to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. A bit later on this evening, we should have a few more of the longer interviews up too. Do please share interviews and story tips on my Tony Gosling Censored Telegram group, on WhatsApp or on my Facebook page. You can message me there, and also download this show, full-length interviews, subscribe to my free weekly newsletter, donate, or even set up a small monthly sub. That's all at the show page, thisweekoneword.org.uk. This show is streamed live from Bristol 5 till 8pm every Friday. We repeat at 11pm and then at 11 and 5am and pm all week, except 5pm Monday to Thursday. Well, when it's not September, you can hear the Richie Allen Show live here on the talkradio.org.uk stream. We're also live at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, at holylandradio.com, at 87.7 FM, West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Bristol Politics Show app. If you can restream this show live or broadcast us elsewhere, please let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5, where I think we'll be talking about trees around the harbour being chopped down by our lovely Green Party, supposedly here running the city. And don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down.
With my usual flair. sure of my lies. No one is there. Don't you love a farce? My fault, I feel. I thought that you'd want what I want. Sorry, my dear. But where are the clowns? Quick, send in the clowns. Don't bother, they're here. Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career. But where are the clowns? There ought to be clowns.
Tomorrow the plow begins.
becomes the sword. Make us stronger in our danger. A soldier.